Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Water.
WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size like a dragon in the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You better cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now. Now.
And welcome, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. We have got a big program in store for you tonight. I've got State Representative Josh Shapiro going to be here talking about the election. And things are tightening up. As I predicted during the summer when the polls were, you know, 10, 15 points apart, I said, the closer we get to election day, things are going to tighten up because people are going to wake up and start paying attention and see just how extreme the Republican Party has become. And, you know, what, like we talked about on our weekend program, what you're seeing now is the Republican Party, the extreme part of the party, now feeling pretty secure in the fact that they can now speak out loud those things that they used to whisper, in their little think tanks and in their little secret clubs at the Chamber of Commerce and so on. Now they can say them out loud, like, do away with the minimum wage. I don't know many people who are in favor of that, but do away with unemployment. I don't know many people who are in favor of that, except the extreme right. Who now has completely taken over the Republican Party. So it should be a good conversation with him. Also, Jeff Raines from the Alliance for American Manufacturing going to be talking about what we need to rebuild in this country for Manufacturing Monday. And also Daniel Curcio, he is a home health care worker. We're going to talk about his story, the work that he does, and this new organizing campaign that's going on to try and organize the home health care workers. And we'll also be talking with Richard Negri and Molly O'Gorman from SEIU about the campaign and how we can make sure that our people who need help, look, a lot of senior citizens want to stay in their home. A lot of senior citizens don't want to go to nursing homes. It's cost effective. It's smart policy to keep people in their home if they can get care at home. I look at my grandmother. There's a nurse that comes in once a week to make sure that she's bathing, make sure she's taking care of herself. It's smart policy, very smart policy, and we'll talk about that. Jake, I got to tell you, this weekend was fantastic with debates. I absolutely loved the debate weekend. I spent all day Sunday watching the debates. My favorite part of the whole debate cycle, Aqua Buddha. Aqua Buddha was my favorite.
That was the topic tonight, Rick. You must be reading my mind. Did you see Rand Paul's reaction?
Oh, he raced off stage like somebody lit him on fire.
He flipped out, didn't he?
And, you know, the thing you got to ask yourself, is this the kind of petulant child you want in the U.S. Senate? Someone who, if he doesn't get his way, he lays on the floor, kicks and screams, and puts his fingers in his ear. You got to wonder, man. What if I were his opponent, I would have been jumping for joy. Saying, thank you, you just gave me my next commercial. And my other question is, if this is what if this is what sent him off in a tizzy, this thing that happened back when he was in college, look, you know, we all did a lot of dumb things when we were young. I've never kidnapped someone and made them worship water, but you know, hey, we have our skeletons, right? But if he ran off in a tizzy over this, I gotta wonder exactly what is in his background. Exactly what else is there?
Well, it's an indication of his personality, and I think that's what the Democrat was trying to do. Rand Paul made a strategic mistake there. Now, whether it'll be fatal, only time will tell. But from what I can gather, Rand Paul's lead is not as great as it was. So.
And what does that
we
say?
Shall see.
What does that say about the? I shouldn't talk. I mean, we've got Pat Toomey here in this state who has a slight lead over Joe Sestak. How a guy who was a derivatives trader can have a lead over somebody who was a career admiral and a defender of the country is beyond me. How somebody who made a fortune doing exactly what got this country into trouble kind of makes me just kind of wonder what's on the brains of voters in this. In this country.
Since you're talking about national developments, did you see the latest on Sharon Engel? Oh my God. She went to one of the public schools with the minority.
Yeah, I saw that.
And said some stupid things.
Really
and,
dumb stuff.
And the polls don't, they don't have Harry running away. Harry should be up by 15, 20 points. And he's not. I mean, sorry, Harry, you're not a real strong candidate, but I think he can still win.
But what's interesting is what we've seen is we've seen conservatism, which has had its facelifts. In fact, it's had more facelifts than Joan Rivers, but it has had its facelifts. And this latest one, wow, they have absolutely backed themselves into an ideological corner here. You cannot promise to end debt. You cannot promise to cut taxes. And you can't promise to return to the Bush policies and think that's the answer to what's wrong in this country. If you remember, the Bush policies were about borrowing and spend. Are we going to go back to that? If we do that, how are you going to cut taxes again? And how are you going to end the debt cycle? I'm not seeing it, folks. And what I'm seeing out of the Republicans right now is nothing but a rehash of the 90s. They're just going back to the same failed policies that got us into this absolute mess that we're in right now. And maybe it's just that we have that short of attention span. Maybe this is short attention span theater, and I just don't know it. But somebody, please.
Oh, I know. Someone made the comment, like people at Sharon, it doesn't matter what they do, what they say. People are so angry right now. And then in Nevada, you have Harry. I mean, people, I guess, are just saying to Harry, it's time to go. And in some of these states, it almost seems like they can say anything, they can do anything. Their past history, their past record, their positions don't mean anything. They're going to be supported by the nutcases on the right. Here's where they lose credibility, and I think perhaps they're losing some of that support in Pennsylvania. When you start explaining the issues and you go into the issues such as Pat Toomey, some of those moderates are starting to rethink their position. Do they want Social Security and Medicare attacked? Do they want more of the same failed economic policies as far as free trade? I think some of these moderates are starting to come over to our side, Rick.
Well, I saw Toomey at, and he was, he was in his restaurant there in Allentown, and I've created hundreds of small business jobs. And the first thing when I saw the picture, they showed him there, and I'm going, hickey and blue collar. I'm going, that's what he's going for. I've seen Pat Toomey a couple of times. He's never looked hickey and blue collar before. I looked at this, and I go, what's with the denim shirt?
Well, I don't know if you know this. We were there, and I know this is hard to believe coming from me. We were there to protest one of his appearances. And then, here come the kids and the wife, and he's this wonderful family man, and he's soft.
I don't doubt that he is.
He's soft. Well,
I don't doubt that he's a wonderful family.
It's part of their philosophy.
Here, I'm not going there.
Well, yeah, I am. If you're going to trek those kids and your whole family to every political campaign, you're trying to say that, look at me, I'm just an average guy. Well, he's not. He's a far-right candidate. His policies have wrecked this country, and he's trying to soften that. Yeah, look, if he's a good father, good for him. He should be. But when you start using your family for political purposes, and I know they all do it, then it becomes fair game. I think he's overused that. He's trying to soften his position, soften his perception of the public.
I mean, the only family question that I've got is the one campaign ad he ran, where he was sitting on the couch reading the 3,000 page Bible there. I don't know that that's something and maybe it does happen.
And that's fair. That's fair game too.
But yeah, to say, I'm not going to go with you to say that he's not a good family man, because
I didn't say he was. But I think it's a bit much to trek your kids, your small kids and your family to every political gathering. And you made the comment about, you know, now he's acting like he's this usually wildly successful entrepreneur. And
he made a lot of money on Wall Street.
No, locally. I'm not talking about Wall Street.
They had a nice little restaurant, and it was a place to dump all the Wall Street earnings. It was a place to, you know, look, it was what it was, and it was a good place. I liked it. I went there often. I'm not gonna attack that. But for him to come and say that he's a small business person, that's a little disingenuous. He was a Wall Street trader, made a lot of money. And came back and said, you know what? I made a lot of money. This is what I'm going
to
do.
And he made it in Wall Street, but he would like you to believe that he made it at the local level, and he pumped all this money, and he created all these jobs. I saw his commercials, Rick. But then again, we talk about commercials. This political season,
wow.
I think some of these candidates are just bending down and pulling out their you-know-what. You know, truth be damned.
Yeah, and the money that's going into these ads is frightening, frightening stuff. I look at some of these chamber ads, and I'm just going, at what point is this stuff education? These are hit pieces. There's no educating. There's no issue orientation here. And when when Karl Rove and American Crossroads comes out and says we're spending $65 million to get Republicans elected, I think there's got to be something there. I think you have got to investigate that, because that's not what the 501c6 was set up for. It just wasn't.
Well, Leo Gerard was on MSNBC tonight, and he was being questioned by Ed, you know, and the question was, do you have foreign money coming into your union? And he said, of course not. He said, our union is transparent. In fact, we have to hand in reports periodically to the feds. And the Chamber of Commerce is using that as an excuse. Well, labor does it. Well, no, labor doesn't do it.
Well, the chamber what they said is, well, you know, the unions get all this international money, and the truth is that they don't. The example that they used was the steelworkers, and the Canadian money from the steelworkers union in Canada stays there. It doesn't come here. They don't commingle the funds. I mean, that's a fallacy, but that's what they want you to believe. It's the big, bad, evil unions that are coming for you. And that's their frame. And it's not true. It has never been true. But when you have that much money, when you can spend $200 million in an election cycle on attack ads, you can pretty much say whatever you want. And it's not surprising that we have Democrats who cannot possibly get their message out. And you look at this cycle, something has got to give. Some type of campaign finance reform has to happen.
Money is overwhelming the system, and to aggravate the system, not only is money overwhelming the system, but we got foreign companies pouring millions of dollars into the election with obvious intent of electing candidates that want more free trade, and they want to move their jobs out of the country so that their business prosper. I mean, that goes to the very heart of our democracy.
Yay,
not only is money buying it, but now foreign money is buying our democracy. That is an absolute disgrace.
Well, the good thing is
people should be outraged.
The good thing is we're seeing smaller state-run and local chambers of commerce saying, you know what, we don't buy into this, into the International Chamber of Commerce. And you're seeing across the country people saying, nope, we're pulling back. We're not going to identify ourselves with them. Because, you know, when people think of the Chamber of Commerce, they think of the small business people downtown.
Absolutely.
The guys who are planting flowers, and the people who are trying to fix up the local communities so that their businesses are more attractive.
The kind of businesses you walk into and right in the front counter is their little plaque, Chamber of Commerce. And these small businesses, which are the heart and soul of the Chamber for years, the chamber's turned their back on them. They're actually hurting them. Now, think about what they're doing here. They're supporting the big corporations that want to move jobs overseas, which means what? Which means you have less people working in the communities where these businesses are, which ultimately hurts their business.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back with Daniel Curcio. Right back after this.
We want the world.
Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. An attempt to require New York City businesses to provide sick days is likely dead on arrival. City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, often a strong supporter of worker initiatives in the city, expressed her opposition on Thursday to the bill. She made her decision out of concern that it would put undue pressure on small businesses in a down economy. The bill would have required businesses with 20 or more employees to provide 9 sick days per year. Pressure continues to mount on food and janitorial service provider Sodexo. The company has been the target of a nationwide campaign that is seeking better wages, benefits, and job protection for the company's workers. This week saw workers at Denison University, Ohio State University, and Clark University walk off the job to picket the company. The French-based company has been accused of using intimidation tactics against workers who have made it known that they are allied with the Service Employees International Union. Protests have been popping up throughout the United States, and the company has dismissed those strikes and pickets as a smear campaign. In this election cycle, a number of Republicans have gone where few Republicans have gone in previous elections, attacking the minimum wage. The most recent Republican to address issues with the minimum wage is John Racey of West Virginia. Racey recently said if given the opportunity, he would seek to abolish the minimum wage because it restricts how much people could actually get paid if the country adhered to supply and demand. In a debate on Wednesday for Virginia's District 1 House of Representatives seat, incumbent Rob Wittman said publicly for the first time that he opposed the federal minimum wage and believes such wages should be left up to the states. His Democratic opponent, Crystal Ball, told the Virginia Gazette that she supports the federal minimum because even with a minimum wage, people can barely get by. Alaska senatorial candidate Joe Miller went even further, suggesting that the minimum wage is unconstitutional. Miller's position is contrary to the Supreme Court's 1941 ruling in U.S. versus Darby Lumber Company that found that the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established the federal minimum wage, was constitutional. Here's today's economic report. Saturday was National Bosses Day in the United States, but a new survey released by Spherion Staffing suggests few employees used it to celebrate management. The survey discovered that 74% of workers said that during the recession, the relationship they have had with their boss has deteriorated. Workers told the survey they didn't feel like their boss is interested in their career development and will often undermine their progress. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free consumer report by Calhoun Associates by visiting pa-workers-comp-lawyers.com or calling 717-695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting pa-workers-comp-lawyers.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
Well, that would be a great idea if we would have gotten the Employee Free Choice Act passed. I got to tell you, that's one of my favorite bands, the Street Dogs. One of labor's finest right now, in my opinion. And I got to tell you, I absolutely love that. When you're looking at the Employee Free Choice Act, gives it the right to workers to organize in a in a more streamlined fashion, not only, you know, to help the workers, but also help companies as well. I look at some of the things that are going on here in the state of Pennsylvania, like the fact that Governor Ed Rendell signed Executive Order 2010-4, which created the Consumer Workforce Council. And what this executive order did is it gave senior citizens and people with disabilities a voice in the long-term care policy of the state of Pennsylvania, along with the ability for the people who take care of those folks to join and form unions so that they can, collectively bargain for some better wages, health care for themselves, maybe in their families, and maybe something for when they retire and when they need help down the road. And I think it's a good thing. I absolutely do. I'm going to talk to Daniel Cursillo right now. Daniel, welcome to the program. How are we doing tonight, Daniel?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
I am fantastic. I appreciate you taking time for me. This new executive order that was signed by Governor Rendell going to give people a right to collectively bargain, to form unions, I think is a great thing. And I wanted to have you come on and tell your story, what you're doing and the work that you're doing to help people in our community.
Well, you know, thanks, Rick. I basically wanted to, you know, first say that I'm proud of these, you know, workers, you know, basically can't be summed up into, you know, one story. And, you know, as diverse as the disabled community and each of our, you know, consumer employer stories are, so are ours. You know, and having said this, I think that the relationship between my consumer employer and me has been a life-changing force for both of us. Jeremiah and I met approximately, give or take, 8 years ago. And I met him, and I kind of sensed that, you know, there might have been some issues that were obstructing his independence. And I feel that after talking to him for a little bit, as we grew closer, I let him know that I thought that he needed a friend to help him out. I'll never forget the day we were walking down the street and he said, you know, I was in a drowning accident when I was a kid. And, is that the reason why I can't get employed? And I was taken aback by that remark. And finally, not knowing anything and having come from an education background, I took him step by step through the things that he needed to get through to gain not only, you know, support from Social Security disability, but also winning the support of having him have a home care worker. From that day forward, I've been working with him. So 4 years basically off the books and 4 years on. So what started out as a friendship is now this cleverly intertwined relationship that's both professional and familiar. And you know, it's sad to know that that there are so many individuals out there that don't know that they may not that they do need attendant care. And it's all about education, and I think that, you know, have our lives not intertwined, the brotherhood we now share would be non-existent. My consumer employer's supported independence would have collapsed, and the joy I have seeing him meet his daily steps and with the objectives and even long-term goals would be crushed. I created for him a program that actually keeps him mentally alert throughout the day. It keeps his mind active. And, that's the, role I play. And, it's not, a physical disability such as, one where he, maybe needs wheels, but, one that, needs his, brain, at work, constantly. And I think for Jeremiah and others like him, it's about choice and, you know, maintaining the power of having skilled and knowledgeable home care workers like me and others. So. So simply put, I think it's similar to the services that, like, nursing homes provide, but it adds this, like, in my opinion, this, like, genuine, familiar, personal, friendly, and professional connection, which added plenty of years to Jeremiah's successful and accomplished life already, a life filled with the right and dignity, I think, both of us on both sides of the table, yet one table, deserve.
Right. So let me ask you, let's go back to the beginning. Your friend Jeremiah, what is his disability, if I can ask?
Yeah, in the brain injury, he was, Rick, he was in a, after the brain injury, he was in a coma for 6 months, actually pronounced dead at the scene. They didn't know if they could have revived him or not. And what ended up happening was because of that, he has anoxic brain damage, which simply put, a lot of his executive functioning is now not working as well as it should be. So things such as judgment and the ability to shift on his own as far as decision-making skills and, you know, alertness and increased vulnerability. I think that without a person such as a personal health care worker in his life, he would probably not be here today.
Well, how old was he when the accident happened?
Well, he was actually 5 years old when it happened, and I think he came out of it at the early age of six, right after he turned six. And the sad story is that he grew up in a very environment that wasn't very supportive, and one that isn't actually uncommon in a family where there's perhaps maybe a disability involved, where there's a lot of isolation, a lot of neglect, and where, you know, one really can't move forward and is hindered. So, you know, stories of, trying to hammer his way through a can of vegetables because there wasn't any prepared meals in the house, because there was, quote-unquote, nothing visibly wrong with him, aren't uncommon. Stories where where Jeremiah would steal from his mother's cabinet Centrum vitamins because he thought that would have been the cure for him are not uncommon. And it's these sad stories that make the hope and message of supported independent living such a true reason to live. So go ahead. I hope I've answered that question.
Yeah, absolutely, and in great detail. Thank you very much. You know, because I look at this story and I say it could be any of our children. And to be honest, you know, I don't know that I'm personally prepared to take care of a child in those needs. And I do believe that you do need professional help in a situation like that, as opposed to what I would think some would say, to put them in some type of a home or some type of an institution to take care of them that way. I think that would be way too costly. So I think what you're doing is the right thing.
Right, and it's less expensive care and a greater quality because there's that one-on-one interactive relationship that they have. You know, I and Rick, in summary, I think it's not necessarily about the idea that all we do is take one person from point A to point B and move them in a wheelchair. That's not what we do. We'll take them from point A to point B, but you know what? We'll have that conversation with them on their way. We make it familiar. We make it real. We make it genuine. And sometimes, and in many cases, that's not what happens. And unfortunately, some of the nursing homes today.
Well, because the nursing home workers, and I have several relatives who work in nursing homes. They're overworked,
overworked, and understaffed.
Absolutely. And you know, I got to be honest. I've spoken to several people who work in facilities like, you know, where they have one or two people that they have to take care of, and their life would be in jeopardy if they weren't there. And I'm surprised every time that the personal connection that's there and the willingness to come in off hours and do things that they're not being compensated for or not being rewarded for, but because it's right. And that's one of the things that I think what you guys do is so fantastic, and you should be commended for doing.
And thank you for that. And the idea that, you know, in addition to all of this, it just creates a lot of jobs at a cheaper cost.
Well, and look, at the end of the day, you've still got to feed your family, and you've still got to take care of yourself as well. But while doing something that you love, I do believe you should be compensated for that as well.
And I agree.
You know, so as we're moving forward with this, because I think what you're doing is terrific, and I think the whole program is a very sound, not only a sound policy, but a smart investment to help keep people in their homes at a lower cost. Whether they have a disability or they're a senior citizen like my grandmother, who has a weekly nurse come in and check on her. I think it's smart policy, but I also think that, as I said before, they should be compensated for it.
Mm. And that's what we're truly working on with this Independence Ride coming up.
Well, I got to tell you, it's amazing work that you do. I hope you keep up the fight and keep up with Jeremiah, and I hope the best for both of you.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Daniel. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. Stick around.
It is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Old Congress critters never die, they just fade away. Into lobbying firms, that is. Take former House Speaker Dennis Hastert, former House Majority Leaders Dick Armey and Dick Gephardt, and former Senate leaders Bob Dole and Trent Lott. The names of these one-time legislative powerhouses aren't mentioned in the news anymore, so perhaps you would assume that they've retired back to the old home place or even passed away. But no, they're very much alive and still plying the legislative arts. Only they now do it for million-dollar paychecks as lobbyists for Wall Street financial giants and other corporate interests. Hastert, Armey, Gephardt, Dole, and Lott are among a cadre of 73 former members of Congress who've been working in recent months to weaken or kill new regulations to rein in the gouging and reckless gambling of the big financial firms. They are not the only former public servants now using their insider knowledge and personal connections in Washington to serve the bankers. For example, at least 66 staffers for the House or Senate banking committees have moved from Capitol Hill to the K Street lobbying corridor. And another 82 staffers for members of those committees also are now lobbyists for the finance industry. Adding even more firepower to this special interest army of influence peddlers are 42 former officials from the Treasury Department. This is Jim Hightower saying, in an effort to slow down this shameless cashing in on public service, the watchdog group Public Citizen contacted 47 current lawmakers who are retiring this year. The group asked them to pledge not to take a lobbying job for 2 years with any corporation that had lobbied them. Not a single one took the pledge. To see who the 47 are and to get behind stricter lobbying rules, contact Public Citizen at www.citizen.org/revolvingdoor.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America, Rick Smith.
Well, right now is a good time. United Home Care Workers of Pennsylvania, they're a joint effort of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, and the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Their mission is to improve and expand quality health care and to protect and improve the lives of working families. And to me, that is a noble goal. It is a noble mission. I've got Molly O'Gorman here with me. She's with SEIU.
Yep.
If you just a little closer.
Okay.
explain what's going on here with this this campaign that you guys are in the middle of right now. Tell me what it is you guys are working towards and what the vision down the road is.
Okay. So in Pennsylvania, you have a large community of seniors, people with disabilities, who want to live in their homes. We heard from Daniel talking about his relationship with Jeremiah and the importance of independence, of being able to maintain your dignity, to have your things, to not be in a nursing home or an institution. And right now in the state, it's sort of backwards. 82% of funding goes towards nursing homes, and only 18% goes towards health care, or home care, rather. Right. So with the executive order that the governor has signed and the ability for home care workers to come together and form a union, what they're really saying is that home care is important to Pennsylvania. It's important that people be able to make decisions to guide and direct their own care. So what we're going to see is home care attendants across the state coming together as part of this independence ride, which is a month-long van tour going through Pennsylvania. This week we're kicking it off here in Harrisburg, going on to Williamsport and Erie. And it's going to give home care attendants, consumers, and consumer advocates an opportunity to tell their stories, but also to meet each other. You know, they don't have the advantage of a central workplace. And so it's really important when we talk about organizing home care workers that we provide points of contact. And so the Independence Ride is one of the ways to do that.
Well, that sounds like a great thing. I know my grandmother, and I try to bring everything back to my personal experiences. My grandmother's 82 years old. She's still fortunate enough to live at home in the house that, you know, she's been in for 50-some-odd years. And it's because we have people who can come in that the state sends out. I believe it's through Medicare somehow. But they come out and they make sure that she's bathing and she's taking care of herself and some of her needs are met. I think it's a fantastic, cost-effective way of helping seniors to not only stay in their homes but live with a little dignity.
Absolutely. And it creates a large number of jobs, performing a service that people want. People, you know, my grandmother, unfortunately, is now in a nursing home because she's unable to care for herself. And her situation, you know, having a home care attendant wasn't possible financially. And with the number of attendants in the area, there's a much greater demand than there are number of attendants. And part of that has to do with it not being a stable, well-paying job with benefits. And
most of the time it falls onto the back of the families.
Right.
And I've often wondered, wouldn't it be a good idea to maybe to help compensate some of the family members for time lost? I know my aunt spends a lot of time with my grandmother.
Right.
It would be in the best interest of everybody that she would get a little help taking care of my grandmother. And I would love to see that across the state.
And we have stories like that all across the state of people who had to leave their jobs where they had a good wage, where they had health care benefits to stay at home and take care of a family member, and now are struggling to care for that family member, but also to care for the rest of the family. Loss of income is a big deal.
It is a huge thing. And as I understand it, maybe I'm wrong here, but are home health care aides covered under the minimum wage?
No.
I was under the impression that they were not.
No.
And is there a push to work on maybe at least trying to get at least that? What's in this executive order? Do you know?
So when we look at the executive order, what it does initially is establish a board of seniors, people with disabilities, and those are the folks who employ the attendants. And it's going to create this consumer workforce council. And there have been similar initiatives across the country in Missouri and Ohio and Connecticut. And that's going to create a consumer employer model of home care and help to facilitate improvements, create a more highly trained, qualified and trained workforce, and also to address issues of wages and benefits.
And this is a private driven initiative. This isn't the state taking on this initiative. This is getting companies who are providing home health care to people. Is this how am I understanding it right?
Right. Yes. Yeah, and so you have now home care attendants paid an average of $9.10 an hour, no benefits. And so this executive order that allows them to unionize, they'll be able to deal with all of the fiscal intermediaries, the companies that pay wages, to have sort of the same benefits everywhere in the state.
And maybe even, the ability to pull all those people together and hopefully buy some health care and maybe some pension stuff, you know, so that the jobs, you're going to want to attract quality, well-qualified people, I would think.
Right. And it's also, you know, it's not just a benefit for home care workers or for, you know, the families of consumers. It's a break for taxpayers in Pennsylvania. So, you know, the Workforce Council is going to save taxpayers money. It's a cost-effective term of delivering long-term care. It costs the Commonwealth about a third as much to provide home care services as it does to provide care in a traditional facility. So you really have the creation of good working-class jobs. You have a highly trained, skilled workforce caring for a growing population of elderly in the state of Pennsylvania. And you have the ability for families to direct the care of their loved ones the way they want to.
Yeah, we have not built nursing facilities as fast as we've built prisons. But I think you're right. As the baby boom generation moves into their 60s and 70s and onward, we're going to need this infrastructure to be able to take care of them, because we don't have the nursing homes. We don't have the ability to, and this is a horrible word, but even just to warehouse people, we don't have the ability to do that.
Right.
And this sounds like, I talk about smart policy, smart investment. This sounds like both. A smart policy moving forward to use a smart investment to keep people, A, in their homes and save me a couple of bucks off my taxes.
There you go.
It doesn't get any simpler than that. We've had Babette Josephs on this program, state representatives, and this was her baby for several years. She's been pushing for this, and it's something worthwhile. If someone wanted to get involved with what you're doing, where would we send them? What would they do?
Sure. So tomorrow is the kickoff for the Independence Riot that's happening in Harrisburg at the Capitol, the lawn across from the Capitol Fountain. At 2 p.m. tomorrow, there's going to be a group of home care workers and consumers getting together to sort of, you know, launch the tour. We're going to unveil our van, which is really cool. It's
nice.
It's all wrapped with photos of attendants and their consumers. And we're going to have people talk about their stories and present the reasons why they're getting involved in the Independence Ride. If you weren't able to make it out tomorrow, you can find us at pahomecareworkers.org or check us out on Facebook at PA Home Care Workers.
And we will get a link up on our website at thericksmithshow.com so that people have access to that. Last question I have for you. You know, we're looking at the employers of these home health care aides, and I'm curious, are you getting much pushback from them, or do they see the value in allowing the workers to come together for all of the good things that come out of having a large pool of employees, the ability to buy health care and pensions and that kind of stuff? Are you seeing any of that?
So there is a lot of support from consumers who want to make sure that the attendant who's caring for them also has the ability to care for their family. Where you start to get some pushback comes with the fiscal intermediaries and with, you know, the folks with the money.
The profits, right.
Right, where it always comes in. But at this point, there is really just a groundswell of support for creating a stable home care workforce.
Because I think everybody agrees, and I know I believe that by having a contract, something written in stone, that you have at least a floor underneath of what the minimum level of care has to be, and you have empowered workers who are going to make sure that is followed.
Yeah, look, unions benefit everybody. We've seen that time and time again in every industry, and home care is no different.
All righty, Molly O'Gorman, I appreciate your time. You can check out their website. Just go to our site at thericksmithshow.com. Click on Molly O'Gorman's name. It'll take you right over there. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this. 1-888-RICK, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717-232-7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
Always by your side.
This is a public service announcement with Kid Tom. Know your rights. Oh, thrill. Number one, you have the right.
One of my favorite bands as a kid growing up, The Clash. I got to tell you, I always loved The Clash. I'm sitting here with Richard Negri from the Service Employees International Union. I just wanted to go back a little bit and talk about this home health care aid thing, because one of the things that I see as a major problem is, as I understand it, this is one of the jobs that were excluded from the minimum wage.
Right.
And I know, Richard, you have been working on that for the last several months. Can you explain why it was excluded?
Well, it goes back a number of years. You know, the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, was signed, I think, 1935. And in order for it to pass, it needed to get the Southern congressional members to sign off on it. So what we understand is that they weren't going to sign it without certain workers not included, and that included agricultural workers as well as home care aides. So that's progressed quite a bit over the years. But the most important thing is that where we are now is that the FLSA kind of looks at home care workers as though they are babysitters. And so therefore they are excluded from the minimum wage. They don't have overtime protection. They don't have health benefits, and it just goes on and on from there.
That's an interesting way of putting it, that they're looked at as babysitters. I see what they do is so much more. I know when I go back and visit my grandmother, the woman who comes and sees my grandmother, I see her as something much more than a babysitter.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's the thing, you know, on various websites, including SEIU.org and other websites that are labor-friendly and progressive-friendly, you know, I've been putting out there the idea that if your elderly grandparent or whatever needed a home care aide, would you call the same babysitter that you call on date night that you take your wife out on? You know, and of course not. I mean, it's ridiculous. So
well, I would hope that that home health care aide would be a lot more reliable.
Yeah.
Than the girl I call to watch our kids every once in a great while.
Exactly. I mean, so people don't realize what goes into this work. Folks, you know, these people are working in other folks' homes, so and they're all over the country, and so it's not like, you know, a trade where you see trucks on the road or you see, you know, you could go to a hospital and see nurses and doctors. These people are fairly invisible until you really need them. And so a good part of what I'm doing is bringing them, in a sense, outside of the house, get them in front of people, and get their work known. You know, talk about the fact that they're lifting these people, they're washing these people, changing them, and the list of their work is endless. It's often thankless, but they're the most humble, down-to-earth people who are doing this for the need to give care. They want to give care, and this is their trade. This is their profession.
Yeah, I remember back during the budget fights, we had spoken with a guy. Tom was his name, I think. He worked in one of these facilities where people lived. Because they couldn't take care of it. It wasn't a nursing home, but it was a house that, you know, a couple of people lived in, and he was responsible for this one person who was non-communicative. Mm-hmm. He talked about going in on his off hours to give someone an enema because they couldn't make it until the next day because they were having such problems, and no one else would be able to do it because the person was combative. And I asked him, I said, so for this great, you know, task that you've taken on, what are you making? He's like $8.25 an hour. And I'm going, that kind of commitment and willingness to put yourself into something the way he did was just seemed amazing to me.
Yeah, and that, you know, and this is, you know, as I've been traveling around quite a bit lately, meeting various home care workers, I get the same thing. You know, they're making very little money. They have no benefits, but this is what they need to do. This is, you know, and it's the same thing with other people in the field, you know, whether they're nurses or doctors, this is their calling. It just so happens that with home care workers, there's very little protection. It's very low wage. And so they're doing it from their heart. They're doing it from, you know, really from their heart, their spirituality, whatever it may be. Because they see that it needs to be done and they're there, they'll do it.
And I see, you know, this campaign and I'm now just learning about it. And I appreciate you guys coming in and talking to me about it. But I see this as a matter of respect.
Yeah,
getting these workers the respect that they obviously deserve to do the things that I've heard some people doing. To be honest, I don't know for that I would do it.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. You know, you and I know each other for a long time, and so we've known, you know, these slogans like, you know, unionize to get a voice at work. And so with this situation, this is quite literal. These people need a voice at their jobs. They need to be able, you know, aside from just organizing their unions, they need to have the dignity and respect to get a fair wage in today's market. They need to be able to afford healthcare. I mean, and it's just like this, you know, bizarre irony that they're giving so much home care, but they can't afford healthcare for themselves. I mean, it's ridiculous in today's, you know, in today's world. And so the way that we combat that is with, you know, collective bargaining agreement that, holds people accountable, that, you know, raises the bottom, and, you know, hopefully make a better life for these people so they can continue to do their trade with even greater dignity and respect that they deserve.
And as we move forward in this, what I would just say is, you know, an entire movement towards making sure the qualifications were up to snuff, because, you know, I look at the next generation, the baby boom generation, as they move forward in their lives, we need to figure out what we're going to do with the folks that are moving into older age, because we don't have room for people in nursing facilities or in hospitals. So we better come up with something, and something quick.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and what you're touching on is a very big part of this whole thing is that because the wages are so low, because, you know, these folks are working sometimes 24, 48 hours a day, and, you know, it's nonstop, There's a tremendous amount of turnover. And as this baby boomer generation gets older and older, where are these home care workers, you know, to pick? Where are they? They're not going to be there unless we make this, you know, a trade that people could have the dignity and respect to go to get a fair wage. And so that's, you know, a big part of what we're doing.
And I think it's a great thing that you guys are doing. And it's a fight worth having, I think.
Yeah.
Especially considering, as we talked about, you know, how you exempt them from the minimum wage still to this day, other than the fact that I think most people were stuck in the idea that, you know, you're going to take care of your parents and in your home, but our culture just doesn't do that anymore.
That's right.
What we have, parents who have their own homes, and we're leading our lives, and things are much, much different. Yeah. The fact that you have two parents who have to work because one parent can't go out in the workforce and make a living for both. That's another big part of this.
Yeah, you know, and recently, I guess it was about a month ago or so, I put up a blog on a non-labor website that's just where most progressives go to and chit-chat on politics. And so I put something up about, does the FLSA hate home care workers? And a lot of people read that and for the first time got their eyes open to the fact that, oh, my God, this is happening in this year. Like, this is not something that we're talking about from 1953. We're talking about now. There are people who are excluded from the minimum wage. They're considered babysitters, and they're doing a trade that not many people would want to do, including, you know, what you just said. You wouldn't do it.
I wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah. So
you know, I barely, you know, that's the thought was just kind of gross there for a second. But the truth of the matter is the baby boom generation is going to need someone to wipe their nose.
That's right.
And the other side as well.
That's right.
And we're going to have to pay someone to do that if they can't do it for themselves.
That's right.
And that's what a humane society does. And I guess you judge our society about how we treat the most vulnerable.
That's right.
And to me, it seems that you're going to want qualified, committed people who are going to do this as a career. To do these kind of things.
That's right. And there's a need for it.
Richard, I appreciate your time, and keep up the good work. And
thanks.
I hope you'll come back with us and talk about how the campaign's going, and hopefully it progresses very well.
All right. And you'll see it all over the Internet. That's what I'm going to be doing for this.
All right. And where would we go to get the Internet site?
So the website is pahomecareworkers.org. We just set up a Facebook page. We set up a Twitter page. We're going to be doing quite a bit of blogging from, you know, PA Home Care. So these are all brand new web environments that are going to be fleshed out over the next week or so. So, you know, and so my part is not only doing a knowledge transfer, but to organize as much as we can online, getting people mobilized around the issues.
All righty. PAHomecareWorkers.org is the website. We put a link up on our site at TheRickSmithShow.com. Great information there. Richard, again, thanks so much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Rick.
Keep up the good work.
All right.
You know, again, you know, as I've said a number of times, you know, we've had people on this program. I remember Babette Josephs, state representative. This was her baby, folks. We've talked about this for years. How do we keep people in their homes? How do we do it cost-effective manner? And how do we do it to keep people with dignity and respect? And for me, that's the big thing. You know, I think of my grandmother, and I think of her often. She's able to stay in her home where her life's memories are. And she does that because there's someone there to help her. There's someone who comes in and makes sure that she has the ability to care for herself, make sure that she gets a bath, make sure she gets, you know, the things that she needs, making sure she's taking her medicines. All that stuff, it's not easy. So we're going to take a quick break right here. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. An attempt to require New York City businesses to provide sick days is likely dead arrival. City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, often a strong supporter of worker initiatives in the city, expressed her opposition on Thursday to the bill. She made her decision out of concern that it would put undue pressure on small businesses in a down economy. The bill would have required businesses with 20 or more employees to provide 9 sick days per year. Pressure continues to mount on food and janitorial service provider Sodexo. The company has been the target of a nationwide campaign that is seeking better wages, benefits, and job protection for the company's workers. This week saw workers at Denison University, Ohio State University, and Clark University walk off the job to picket the company. The French-based company has been accused of using intimidation tactics against workers who have made it known that they are allied with the Service Employees International Union. Protests have been popping up throughout the United States, and the company has dismissed those strikes and pickets as a smear campaign. In this election cycle, a number of Republicans have gone where few Republicans have gone in previous elections, attacking the minimum wage. The most recent Republican to address issues with the minimum wage is John Racey of West Virginia. Racey recently said if given the opportunity, he would seek to abolish the minimum wage because it restricts how much people could actually get paid if the country adhered to supply and demand. In a debate on Wednesday for Virginia's District 1 House of Representatives seat, incumbent Rob Whitman said publicly for the first time that he opposed the federal minimum wage and believes such wages should be left up to the states. His Democratic opponent, Crystal Ball, told the Virginia Gazette that she supports the federal minimum because even with a minimum wage, people can barely get by. Alaska senatorial candidate Joe Miller went even further, suggesting that the minimum wage is unconstitutional. Miller's position is contrary to the Supreme Court's 1941 ruling in U.S. v. Darby Lumber Company that found that the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established the federal minimum wage, was constitutional. Here's today's economic report. Saturday was National Bosses Day in the United States, but a new survey released by Spirion Staffing suggests few employees used it to celebrate management. The survey discovered that 74% of workers said that during the recession, the relationship they have had with their boss has deteriorated. Workers told the survey they didn't feel like their boss is interested in their career development and will often undermine their progress. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Well, that seems to be what's going on. It looks like Bank of America is going to be resuming their foreclosures here in the next week in the 23 states where they said they can go right on ahead. Also, in a Huffington Post op-ed yesterday, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan argued that, quote, a national blanket moratorium on all foreclosure sales would do far more harm than good. And Donovan joined White House advisor David Axelrod in allowing for foreclosures with valid documents to move forward. I guess the question is, what do we mean by valid documents? Kind of makes you wonder. Let's go to the phone lines. We've got Christian on line one. How are we doing today, Christian?
Hey, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for the...
I wrote about this, and it's amazing because all last week, on CNBC and with what you were just talking about with the Bank of America foreclosures, and they were putting a stop on it, and they were arguing. They had this pseudo-argument on CNBC, and they were talking about how, why is this foreclosure mess happening? How did it happen? Where is it coming from? And you had some pundits that were asking, you know, because they had, I guess, these robo-signers and all these, it looks like the banks weren't looking at the documentation that they were proceeding with these foreclosures with. And you did have a couple pundits that were asking, you know, well, what was going on during the origination side that so many of these loans are foreclosing on? And I'm in Florida, so I have the perspective of being in Florida in the situation here, and I have the perspective of being a banker at that time period. And what another pundit said is basically, this was the attitude of Wall Street, this was the article, was that basically if you didn't pay your mortgage, you're at fault. And that's your fault, and that's what Wall Street is sort of attacking back and saying is that if you just didn't pay your mortgage, you're at fault. And I said, you know, it's really funny, but how come no one is talking about the appraisal situation? And I call it a scandal, but no one's speaking about how at this time period, if you bought a home, and especially in an area, you know, like Florida, where if you bought a home between 2001 and 2006, there is a very likely chance that your appraisal for that home was ratcheted up beyond belief on all ends. And I'm talking about people that went to the bank and got a home equity loan. Those people got appraisals that were out of this world. People that were buying a home, they were getting appraisals that were, you know, 20-30% in literally a period of, like, you could buy the home in 6 months, go to appraise it, and it's worth 30% more. I mean, that's the kind of nonsense that was going on. So if you're sort of an unsuspecting buyer and you don't really, you're thinking, you know, the appraisal is supposed to be legal and ethical, and you purchased the home, you're thinking that it's been appraised at a proper value. And the fact is, that's the reason why you see, especially, you know, and again, in Florida, that's why you see these home prices that have dropped to the floor, which prompts people to jump out of their mortgages even more.
Right.
That's what you have the attorneys telling them down here. It's worth it not to pay because you're so far underneath your loan.
Well, I got to tell you, it wasn't just the appraisals in Florida. It was the appraisers here in Pennsylvania, because I remember, you know, buying a house where the appraiser said, oh, we did a drive-by. They didn't bother to look at it. They just drove by, took a picture on the, didn't even slow down to take the picture because it was blurry. But they drove by and they took a picture, and they gave whatever the realtor told them to give. Because I had bought a house, and then I've told this story before, bought a house in 2001 for $140,000. I sold it, 4 years later for $200,000. There's no way you had $60,000 worth of increased value in that home in just 4 years. No way. But, that's what the whole system was doing. It was pumping up the prices because the realtors had a vested interest in it, higher commissions. The loan appraisers had a vested interest in it, more business. The banks had a vested interest in it, pumping out, you know, more loans and being able to sell off. It was this perverse system, and now it's collapsed. So what do we do now? And now I find out that they half the time they don't even have the notes. They don't even have the right paperwork. And they're getting people who were former janitors to sign off on these foreclosures. Something has got to happen, and this is where I think the Obama administration has to step forward and do something.
Well, the thing is, the line you'll get from it, they call them short-selling attorneys, their sales line is literally, how much did you pay for your home? How much is it worth today? You might as well stop paying it.
Yeah.
And if your home was worth $300,000 and it's worth $150,000 today, that's a pretty darn near good argument. I mean, you can't really argue with that. It's going to take you 60 normal years to get back that type of value. But the thing about you said the Obama administration, the Making Homes Affordable was a disaster. That program has been a disaster. Because no one feels the necessity to pay something that has basically went up in value. They purchased it at the top, and then now it's worth half or two-thirds of what they purchased it at. That's the true reason, and nobody wants to do it. But there needs to be some type of principal reduction or way to give back the keys, perhaps that type of program, so that people don't have to sit there and feel like they're paying into a black hole.
Yeah, I said that right from the beginning, Christian. I appreciate the call, buddy. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
But, you know, if you remember, Jake, it's exactly what I said from the beginning. Right when all this happened, what needs to happen, we need to go back to the Homeownership Loan Corporation like they had after the after the Great Depression. The bankers have to take a haircut because you have to reappraise those homes and make loans based on the reappraisals. And that's just not for, you know, people who are in financial trouble. I said you should have done it for everybody who had a mortgage. Go back and recalculate the whole thing. Sorry, bankers, you screwed this up. You're going to have to pay part of it.
I would love to see that also, Rick. Given the makeup of Congress right now, I don't know. Banking industry is very powerful.
So what we're going to have is we're going to continue to see these massive foreclosure numbers. Because the truth be told, if I were that deep under my mortgage, where, like, as he's pointing out, you paid $300,000 for a $150,000 house, I can't say that I would stand there and slug it out. You just go, you know what? Oops.
Isn't it amazing, whether it's banks or it's a corporate entity, when it's your fault, it's your fault. But when they screw up and they screw up people's futures and lives, all of a sudden they're there. Isn't it amazing with a helping hand, unabashed, to the federal government?
Yeah, if it were a corporation that did something like this.
All of a sudden they're socialist.
If it was a corporation, they could file bankruptcy and still get to keep the property. I mean, that's the beautiful part
of it. It's amazing. We don't want socialism in this country. Remember?
But I said from the very beginning, the first thing we should have done is we should have made the homeowner whole. You want to solve the mortgage crisis? You make the homeowner whole first. You start at the bottom, and you correct the problem from the bottom up. What I wanted to see done is, like I said, you needed people back to work. You hire a bunch of paper pushers to redo all the mortgages. That would be enough work to generate for a couple years. And as people come in, they refinance their mortgage at a reasonable current rate, at current values, so everybody's got to pay into it. There's nobody getting a free house. Nobody gets to live in their house for free. You're paying, but the people who caused this mess, they got to pay too. And that's where I thought we would have had if we would have done it right away, where it would have been a great opportunity. And I don't know if you saw this today, but Citibank's shares jumped more than 3% after the third quarter. They're up to a profit of $2.2 billion in profit between July and September. So they're estimating, there's a forecast that it's going to be, their profits for this year is going to be well above the $101 million profit they had last year at this time. So interesting stuff. Wall Street giants still 12% owned by the federal government. Its revenues for the quarter were down a little bit, but still very profitable. And, you know, the banks are profitable. The bonuses are back. Compensation's up. Wall Street thinks everything's wonderful. So now's a good time, I think.
For them. For them. But what about Main Street? If I can mention something, you know, we talk about this crisis, and it is horrible. I mean, home ownership is the quintessential American dream, but if you think about it, it's a perfect storm. Not only did you have a system that was eating itself, you had the economy going flat, you had people being laid off, and don't forget, healthcare. 2 million people lost their job, well, actually 1 million in a 2-year period. That's an awful, awful lot of homes. And those represent, most of them represent families.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I don't know what I would do in that situation. You know, unfortunately, I didn't get into that. And unfortunately, this area didn't see that kind of a boom. I know Allentown saw a little bit. I know some areas, Miami, the whole state of Florida really saw a massive, massive boom. And then, and that's what the conservatives want to take us back to. That's conservative world. It's the world of boom and bust. When you have no regulation, when you have no oversight, when you have nobody who's paying attention, and all of this stuff was foreseeable. Anybody who bothered to look, and I had real estate agents tell me, you know, we were getting as much as we could because we knew the holiday was going to end. They were out there pushing and pushing and pushing. And, you know,
right now in the town I live, I have a friend that, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful home. They reduced the asking price by 25%. Can't sell it. Talk about overinflated. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break right here. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to come back with Jeff Raines from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Since it is Manufacturing Monday, Jeff is going to talk to us a little bit about what's going on with their group there at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. We're right back after this.
Get away. Get away. Future Smart Policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Old Congress critters never die. They just fade away. Into lobbying firms, that is. Take former House Speaker Dennis Hastert, former House Majority Leaders Dick Armey and Dick Gephardt, and former Senate leaders Bob Dole and Trent Lott. The names of these one-time legislative powerhouses aren't mentioned in the news anymore, so perhaps you would assume that they've retired back to the old home place or even passed away. But no, they're very much alive and still applying the legislative arts. Only they now do it for million-dollar paychecks as lobbyists for Wall Street financial giants and other corporate interests. Hastert, Armey, Gephardt, Dole, and Lott are among a cadre of 73 former members of Congress who've been working in recent months to weaken or kill new regulations to rein in the gouging and reckless gambling of the big financial firms. They are not the only former public servants now using their insider knowledge and personal connections in Washington to serve the bankers. For example, at least 66 staffers for the House or Senate banking committees have moved from Capitol Hill to the K Street lobbying corridor. And another 82 staffers for members of those committees also are now lobbyists for the finance industry. Adding even more firepower to this special interest army of influence peddlers are 42 former officials from the Treasury Department. This is Jim Hightower saying, in an effort to slow down this shameless cashing in on public service, the watchdog group Public Citizen contacted 47 current lawmakers who are retiring this year. The group asked them to pledge not to take a lobbying job for 2 years with any corporation that had lobbied them. Not a single one took the pledge. To see who the 47 are and to get behind stricter lobbying rules, contact Public Citizen at www.citizen.org/revolvingdoor.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, back in 1974, the United States, we passed a trade act. It gave the president the ability to react to situations that, like the one we're facing with China. The fact that they're dumping product here, the fact that they're manipulating their currency, and really, really a failure or an unwillingness to recognize patents or copyright laws. This trade act gave us a weapon against these type of things. And you might remember me talking about this at the beginning of September, but the U.S. Steel, the United Steelworkers, filed a Section 301 claim against the Chinese for unfair trade policies. And as I said that, I'm just stunned that the steelworkers have to be the one doing it, that our government isn't doing it, the companies aren't doing it to protect themselves, that it's actually the representatives of the workers who are willing to stand up not only for the country, but also for these corporations who are being killed by it. It's amazing to me. But here we are, 36 years the law has been on the books. Nobody seems to be willing to stand up to these foreign corporations. That is until now. It turns out the Obama administration is finally taking this latest 301 claim to the WTO. And really, honestly and truthfully, it's about time we fight back and it's about time we defend ourselves. It's just amazing. I've got Jeff Raines on the phone. He's with the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is the website. Jeff, thanks for taking time for me.
You're welcome, Rick.
You know, I'm looking at this 301 case and I'm going, why is it that it's the steel workers who have to do this? Why isn't our government doing it? Why aren't corporations doing it? Why does it have to be the steel workers?
Well, in my case, I worked for 31 years for a steel corporation, for National Steel. We filed bankruptcy due to unfair trade. So I took the opportunity to go to work with the AAM, and we've taken up the gauntlet, and we're trying to seduce them about it. Just last year, for the first time in over 130 years, our steel plant was shuttered completely. And one of the things that happened was that we had steel from India just coming through our town in train loads, and we were in an uproar about it, and over 5,000 people got in the streets and walked through the streets, and the people were starting to realize what's happening, and so the steelworkers have led the charge.
What scares me is I think it might be a little too late that people are finally waking up. This has been something that's been going on, in my opinion, for 30 years since Ronald Reagan swept into office and brought us these bizarre neoliberal trade policies, ones where we can just allow corporations to go overseas and then ship their products back here without any repercussion, without any tariff, without anything to protect U.S. industry, and then we're surprised when we lose jobs.
Well, we from the AAM, and obviously we're sponsored by the United Steelworkers and the large corporations, U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal, and we've decided to fight this, and we've had some successes. I mean, in past administrations just let ITC rulings just slide by. President Obama has signed a couple of ITC, signed some rulings in our favor with the ITC. We've done some work on rubber. We've done some work on steel, on oil country tubular products, and we are starting to make some headway, and I think people are starting to realize that we're losing the lifeblood of this country right now. I mean, good-paying, family-supporting jobs are leaving our shores, and it's time that we hold whoever goes and gets into office accountable for those losses.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, here's the thing. You look at the tire case, and what surprised me about the tire case that the president signed off on and that we actually decided to put some tariffs on is that it was, again, the steelworkers who did it. The companies didn't do it and really didn't want it because they're profiting, thank you very much, by moving their products, their production to China and being able to bring those Chinese-made, in my opinion, inferior quality tires back here to the U.S. and charging the exact same price, but pocketing the difference.
Well, President Girard from the steelworkers really led the charge on that, and he got people fired up, and people have told us that he spends more time in Washington, D.C. than anywhere else now, and he is leading the charge, and now other people are starting to realize what's going on, and I think that's just the start. We just got through hearing the ITC just got through hearing a case on paper products. We're also talking about glass products. Everything that can be made in this country is trying to be outsourced, and we're trying to stop that. And I think people are starting to become aware of that.
Well, they better, because the job that they may save may be their own.
Absolutely.
And what's frightening is, you know, I look at your area. I believe you're out in the Chicago, St. Louis area there?
In the St. Louis area, yes, sir.
The St. Louis. As I remember it, you know, when I used to work for a trucking company, that all they did was supply the auto industry. And I remember you guys had a ton of plants out there. And as I understand, most of them are gone.
Right. We used to be the number two producer of automobiles in the nation, right behind Detroit. But just recently, we lost in Fenton, Missouri, we lost a Chrysler assembly plant. 4,000 jobs were shipped overseas, well, actually to Mexico. Just last year, we lost an assembly plant in Hazelwood, a Ford plant. That was another 2,000 jobs. And associated with those jobs are all the jobs they support.
Yeah, jobs and all of the jobs that come from servicing the people who have the money. I mean, really, and that's something we never talk about. You know, when you have a decent, when you have a manufacturing facility in your area that pays good wages, there are a bunch of smaller businesses that crop up around them that aren't related to that industry. There are restaurants and stores and movie theaters and all those things that crop up around because people have disposable income.
Right, and that's exactly what we focused on last year. We had the automobile supply chain tour, and we went around the country to factories that didn't make the car itself, but they made something that went on the car. I mean, the number one user of coated paper products was the car industry for their catalogs and their showrooms. And people just don't think of that, of the other big jobs that are going with just that assembly plant.
You know, I've always said I'm a firm believer. I'm a staunch protectionist. And people get all, oh, my God, you're a protectionist. I'm not an isolationist. You know, when I leave my house, I lock the door. I protect the things inside my. I think we should do the same thing to the country. Now, I didn't dig a big moat around my house. I'm not an isolationist, and I don't think we should be isolationist either. But there are certain things we should be protecting, like the ability to make steel, because if we're going to be a war society, we better be able to make a gun or a boat.
Well, absolutely. And we, the Alliance, are not asking that we do away with free trade. We do away with fair trade. We want to do away with free trade, okay?
Yep,
if we have to abide by rules, then those people that are supplying products to the number one consumer in the world, the U.S., should live by the same rules we do.
Yeah, I'm right there with you because, I believe in trade. When I was a kid, learned to trade baseball cards. You learned about trade, and you learned who was making the good deals and who wasn't. And I think we're making a lot of very bad deals. I think we're making deals based on what's best for you and I, the working people. We're making it for it's best for who's sitting in the CEO boardrooms.
Right, and well, all we ask is that the American worker get a fair chance, a fair shake. We can work with any workers in the world. We can compete with any worker in the world, given a fair and balanced playing field. But with what's going on in trade right now, we need to revisit our trade policies. Those that are good trade policies, we need to enforce them. And those that aren't, we need to review those and see what we can do about those.
Yeah, I am absolutely right there. Can you tell me some successes that you've seen as you've been out doing your work? Because I know the Alliance for American Manufacturing is doing a series of town halls where they're going out in different communities and trying to get people trying to give people a little education and understanding of where we should be moving as opposed to where we've been.
Well, there's a lot of successes. We're going through 10 different states and holding town hall rallies in 12 cities, St. Louis being one of them. And a number of people want to come, and what we're doing is we're charging the candidates to tell us what they're going to do if elected. We're not partisan. We're not for one side or the other. We're asking you, what will you do to help manufacturing if, in fact, you are elected? We ask, what will you do to, for the first time ever, we have more people drawing unemployment than working in manufacturing. We need to do something about that. People need good-paying jobs.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. This is one of those things where I talk to my Tea Party friends, and I say, look, we can disagree on some things. But manufacturing is something I don't think anyone in the working class can possibly disagree with. The fact that we should be producing things. And I've said this a number of times. The fact that for the first time, I think this year, for the first time in over 100 years, we are not going to be the number one producer of value-added goods in the world. That is not a good sign.
No, it's not a good sign. And those countries, well, obviously you're talking about China. Next year, China will probably overtake us and be the number one manufacturing nation in the world for the first time ever. But we're still the number one consumer nation, okay?
Right.
So, I mean, the Chinese, it's fine if they make a lot of things, but sell their stuff over there and give us a fair chance to sell our stuff over there. I mean, we're running a trade deficit over there to the tune of $280 billion. That's crazy. We're talking about what can we do to cure this economy. Let's bring some of that work back over here.
That's exactly right. And the other thing that bothers me is they didn't grow their manufacturing base by beating us. We gave it to them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those in the know, I've talked to some patent attorneys. When we send a product over there, sometimes they have to sign waivers saying that the intellectual rights are there in a matter of years, 4 or 5 years. And another gentleman told me that if you send it over there, you better not be able to tear it apart or they'll reverse engineer it and they'll be making it before you know it. So, I mean, things that we abide by, when they send their stuff over here, we don't steal their ideas and they shouldn't be allowed to steal our ideas.
Well, what does that say about the company who's willing to go over there and sign away their patent? What does it say about the company who knows that if they take their product over there, it's going to be retro-engineered and it's going to be reproduced cheaper there and sold back here, basically putting them out of business? What does it say about them and the intelligence of the people running those businesses? I mean, I don't see any. I see no upside.
Well, and that's that's why one of the things that we're asking for any Congress that gets in to do is to reward those companies that are keeping manufacturing here on these shores, okay?
Yep.
And not rewarding companies that are outsourcing our jobs.
Makes perfect sense.
Aren't people getting tired of refinishing their basement so their kids can live with them the rest of their life? Wouldn't they like for them to have a job that they can go to and raise a family and have a good life?
I know I sure do. That's the America that I always envisioned. Jeff Rains, I got to tell you, a great conversation. I think the work that you guys are doing is desperately needed, and I think these town hall meetings are great. We watched some of it on the Ustream that you guys put up from Wheeling, West Virginia. But again, you know, keep up the fight and best of luck.
Well, thanks a lot for allowing me on the show tonight, Rick, and you keep up the fight, too, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
All right, look forward to having you back again real soon, Jeff.
Okay.
Jeff Rains from the Alliance for American Manufacturing. AmericanManufacturing.org is the website. We're going to take a quick break right here, right back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free consumer report by Calhoun Associates by visiting PA-workers-comp-lawyers.com or calling 717-695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of the seven deadly sins that can destroy your Pennsylvania workers' compensation case by visiting PA-workers-comp-lawyers.com or calling 717-695-4722.
On June 25th, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this or any other country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling over hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44-hour work week, a 25-cent minimum wage, and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded children from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been changed or amended at least 43 different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away protections such as the Taft-Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40-hour work week, minimum wages, overtime, and child labor protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, workers were at the mercy of their employers, and children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You gotta love the tea party. Well, you know the thing is things have gotten so crazy. You got the woman in Delaware who won't touch herself. You got the guy in Kentucky, the Aqua Buddha in Kentucky there. You've got, What are the crazy people? We got the guy in Ohio running through the woods in Nazi uniforms.
Don't forget Mr. Miller.
Well, Mr. Miller, who
did
just,
you see what he did over the weekend?
You gonna blow that for me too?
No, go ahead. I don't want to. You know, you're the number one enchilada in this show.
You know, with all the craziness that's been going on, as I've been saying, people are finally going, "Hey, too much insanity." And ABC News has moved the Pennsylvania Senate race into the toss-up category. It had been leans Republican. It is now an even race. So from here forward, there is an excellent opportunity for the Admiral, Congressman Joe Sestak, to pick up this seat, a seat that, I got to be honest with you, I never thought should have even been considered for Pat Toomey because he is that ultra extreme.
Well, first of all, Rick, I mean, you know, we got to look at the political reality. You know, the country's angry, but beyond that, I mean, realistically, if you remember, you know, don't write him off. He almost beat Arlen Specter, if you remember the last time. They were targeting this race. Even if the economic times wouldn't have been as bad, the Republican National Committee was targeting this race. They were funding for the last year. They were funding huge amounts of money into this race. Then you add on to that the Supreme Court decision, you know, Citizens United, and you got even more money coming in. You got an angry electorate. You know, Joe Sestak is a U.S. congressman, but I got to tell you, out in the street, when you go and talk to people and you explain to people beyond the commercials what Toomey's about, they're alarmed. I mean, I don't know if 90's probably a little bit too high, but I'd say at least 75% of the people, when you explain to them that Toomey wants to do with Social Security and Medicare, that alarms people, and it should. And on top of that, he's a strong advocate of more free trade, which has just killed this state.
And the country as a whole. But, you know, you look at some of the weird stuff that went on this weekend. You brought up Miller in Alaska handcuffing someone to a chair. His bodyguards handcuffed someone for asking a question. You know, is that the libertarian way? I don't think so. This is a guy who said, you know what? I'm not going to answer any more questions about my personal life.
Yeah.
I'm not answering any more questions. So the guy starts asking a question. They handcuff him to a chair. You know, I got to tell you, that's scary stuff to me. And then you look at this quack out there in Nevada, this Sharon Angle, who said, and this is her quote, quote, "So that's what we want is a secure and sovereign nation. And, you know, I don't know that all of you are Latino." She's talking to a group of Hispanics. "I don't know that all of you are Latino. Some of you look more Asian to me." Really? Really? And in fact, the people on her campaign ad, she wasn't sure if those were Asians or Hispanics either. She just said, "Well, we've got to protect the northern border too, because that's where terrorists came through." You know, this chick needs help.
Yeah, but she went a little further. Not only at that point, she had her foot in her mouth, and then she made a goofy comment about, "Well, you know, when I ran, they thought I was Hispanic too." So, I'm one of you.
She's using the Christine O'Donnell frame. I'm you.
Go figure.
She's a chameleon. Whatever crowd she's around, she morphs into that.
You know, it's like the commentator said, why at this point, in a critical point, would you go to a school and talk to a whole group of minorities?
She's nuts.
First of all, they can't vote. Sorry. They can't vote, and then she sticks her foot in her mouth, and it's on national TV.
Well, because she's flipping nuts. I mean, really, that's the only excuse I can come up with. The only rational thought here is that she's off the path. You know, she's off the beaten path. She's into the weeds. That's all I can come up with. And you look at this guy in Ohio, this Rich Ayotte, the big millionaire guy, who's basically funding his own campaign and then saying, "Well, you see, Marcy Kaptur takes money from other people."
Hello?
I mean, it's the weirdest thing.
And your point?
Well, the thing is, the guy's nuts. But John Boehner, Boner, Bono.
Just call him Tan Man. Right?
Tan Man. Mr. Orange. The Orange Man. The House Minority Leader. He has given him money. Here's a boatload of money. Don't worry about it. I'm still standing behind my guy. He says he doesn't fear any backlash. The website of Boehner's Freedom Project PAC has a page dedicated to introducing potential donors to Rich Ayotte, who is seeking to unseat Marcy Kaptur in the Toledo area, the 9th District. You'll know they donated some money to him back in September, and they're before the images of him in his Nazi uniform, of course. But they're not going to ask for the money back, and they, it happens. I actually had someone try to defend Ayotte's running around the woods and dressing up as a Nazi. Because he said that, and I can't make this up. He said someone had to play the bad guy. And I had to laugh because he said, again, someone always plays a Union soldier during the Civil War reenactments. So I guess this guy's rationale was the Union soldiers are like Nazi soldiers.
Yeah, I think you have it right. I know you touched on it. You said due to the times that some of these crazies on the right are really saying publicly what they would whisper privately. And I think perhaps this guy's acting out what he really feels. And that's kind of scary.
Here's the thing. I question the motive. You gotta wonder what the whole point of it is. But as a history buff, and come out and say it. Look, I'm a history buff.
Let me ask you something, Ray.
I would never do it.
If you think it's cool, and you look at the pictures, he seems awful content. He's proud of himself. Am I wrong on that?
In fact,
I've seen the photos.
In fact, during the debate that he had with Marcy Kaptur, he was talking about his rank within this crazy group that he belongs to that dresses up like Nazis and runs around in the woods. He actually has a rank in his little group. Which is really weird.
Well, if it's just about, what did he say, having fun with his son, well, why don't he dress up as a Union soldier? Why don't he dress up as a Confederate soldier? Why don't he dress up as a Revolutionary War soldier? I mean, a Nazi? Some level, Rick, there has to be a certain level, and maybe you think I'm hard on him, there has to be a certain level of admiration for the Nazis.
Yeah.
And what they stood for.
See, I got to be honest with you. I would have, I don't think I would have as much disgust for him if he dressed up as a transvestite and ran around in leather. I might actually respect that over dressing up and running around out of the woods like a Nazi. But that's just my prejudice. Maybe there's some folks out there who don't mind the fact that he does this.
Look,
and maybe they'll vote for him. It will really be interesting, honestly.
Come on.
It'll be interesting to see how many votes he gets.
We're not talking about a civil war where you had soldiers in the North and the South who fought for what they thought was right. We can argue that. I mean, that war was decided.
Well, you bring it up.
You can make good points on both sides. If I would have been born in the South during the Civil War, I would have felt the same way.
Weren't you?
My point is this. You look at the historical significance of what happened in World War II and how many people died in the turmoil and the absolute hell on earth that the Nazis and their movement brought to this earth because of their philosophy, because of their super race. This idea that we were better than everyone, this idea that we had to expand our nation to survive, that brought the world to the point of extinction.
Well, what's really scary is 13%, and this is just a poll that came out today, 13% of the Germans today want a Führer to come back because they believe the multiculturalism in their country has failed them. And it's the same argument you're hearing from our right here. So when you see this guy dressing up in Nazi apparel, again, I go back to, look, these folks, it's funny, ha-ha, this goofball dressing around running up in the woods, but there are elements in our society who would not mind seeing a Führer here.
Well, worse, they deny that the Holocaust ever happened. I mean, that's crazy. How can you seriously, publicly say the Holocaust never happened? Come on. That's crazy.
Yep. We got to take a quick break right here. Stick around. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care, and your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather be collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are. Not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
Officially in love with Michelle Bachmann, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
In Las Vegas, ABC's reporter Jonathan Carl was shocked to see Scott Ashton. He's the independent Tea Party candidate in Nevada, which I'm still trying to figure out how Sharon Angle can be the Tea Party favorite when this other guy has also taken on the Tea Party moniker. Which Tea Party are we talking about? Which one is Sharon involved in? The corporate one or the make-believe one? Because yeah, I can't figure it out. Or is this guy the corporate one because he drove up in his Mercedes worth $158,000 and he's talking about, hey, you know, I'm Mr. Every Guy. Yeah, all those guys who are standing out in the Tea Party thing, they're signing smaller government, less spending, who are on unemployment. Yeah, they're driving around $138,000 Mercedes. Yeah, let me know how that works out. But again, you know, it comes back down to this frame. And finally, the media is picking up on some of this. And I got to be honest, with a couple weeks to go, we're starting to see the media, who once gave it the Tea Party their power, now taking it away. And, you know, the story in Kentucky, you know, Senator Acquabuda there. If you would have seen this guy storm off stage like a petulant child. I mean, you could not ask as a candidate, even a bad candidate like the guy who's running against him, you couldn't ask for a better moment than to see him like, you know, like a scolded child run off stage.
Well, here's the irony. Let's say that this is really a key issue, and let's just for the moment say he loses. You know, it's discouraging, Rick. I mean, this guy has taken so many extreme positions. Why would he have a lead right now? I mean, I'm sorry, but wow, where are the people in Kentucky and this guy? This guy wants to go back again. We keep saying 100 years, but that, you know, if he would get what he wants, you would go back pre-1950 anyway. On some of the things he's talking about, he doesn't agree with some of the civil rights laws and, you know, a lot of things that that we've taken for granted for the last 50, 60 years.
You know, but like a good libertarian, he's in favor of smoking pot and, you know, kidnapping a woman and taking her down to the water.
And worshiping the water?
Worshiping the Aqua Buddha, which I was told, and, you know, I'm not into the drug culture, but I'm told the Aqua Buddha is actually a water bong, which I did not know. I did not know that.
Ah.
So there you go. You learned something tonight.
Well, according to what the Democrats said, I believe it was Baylor University where he went.
Right.
The group that Rand Paul belonged to had been banned from the university because the chancellor said it was an organization that was mocking religion. So they banned it from Baylor, which I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is a fairly religious school. Is it a Baptist school? I'm not sure. But anyway, now there's a legitimate criticism. If in fact he joined a group that mocked religion, I believe that's a legitimate point to question his motives. Now, well, let's the Aqua Buddha, hey, we all do stupid things.
Well, let's listen to his ad.
Conway, I approve this message.
Why was Rand Paul a member of a secret society that called the Holy Bible a hoax that was banned from mocking Christianity and Christ? Why did Rand Paul once tie a woman up, tell her to bow down before a false idol, and say his God was Aqua Buddha? Why does Rand Paul now want to end all federal faith-based initiatives and even end the deduction for religious charities? Why are there so many questions about Rand Paul?
And, you know, the last two things I'm in favor of. You know, Rand and I would get along just fine on that vein.
Any faith-based
and charitable deductions of the churches. I'm right there with him on that. But, you know, come out and say, look, yeah, okay, you know what happened. We were a bunch of drunken, you know, adolescents. We all make mistakes. Move on. You know, but, you know, he didn't do that. You know, he farmed off and was, you know, that, to me, is just a beautiful campaign moment if you're running against him. And I hope, I do hope, because I do think Rand Paul is way too extreme. I do hope that it does hurt him, and it should.
Absolutely.
And it absolutely should.
I think he kind of, and here's another thing, I think Rand Paul, and he can believe what he wants to believe, but I think he hid behind religion a little bit too much. I think you're right. If he would have just sloughed it off and said, look, I was useful, it was a youthful exuberance kind of thing, you know, testing the waters and testing the limits. I think most people would have said, yeah, you know what, I've done things too in my life. I think most of us have that we're not particularly proud of. And then leave it at that instead of reacting the way he did and hiding behind religion and his family. I think he overreacted. I think he could hurt him.
Well, you know, you go back to that religion they so much love to tout. You know, let he without sin cast the first stone.
You know? Well, you know what bothers me about some of these people? And again, you can believe what you want to believe. I don't particularly care if you're a Buddhist, a monk. You don't believe in God, whether you're a Christian, a Catholic, you know, remember the Jewish religion. But, you know, if you profess to be a Christian, somewhere along the line, there's Christian ethics. I don't know, maybe the things that Jesus Christ taught, Christ as in Christian, would manifest itself in your life or at least in your political beliefs. But some of these people, I mean, they take political stances. I'm saying, whoa. Where are you coming from here? That's where I have a problem with.
Coming from the deep where the Aqua Buddha lives. You know, I stop and I think about this guy. And I probably knew him in college. I knew a bunch of guys just like that, who, you know, through the years they did all of those things that college kids do. They smoked pot. They did a little bit of this. They did a little bit of that. They experimented with, you know, with what life had to offer. And then you grow up. Look, I'm not gonna put him down for things he did, you know, when he was a young man. You know, things happen. You learn from your experiences, and hopefully you don't do them again. You know, as I've told kids that I've mentored, you're going to make a lot of mistakes, as we all have. Just make sure that those mistakes aren't so large that they follow you for the rest of your life. And I don't think this is one of those mistakes. Now, I don't know if the abduction charge here, you know, 20-some-odd years later, mm-hmm. it would still stick. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the whole background.
Now that's
about
another
that.
Issue. According to what...
according to what the woman said, she tied him. He
now,
tied
he's trying
him
to say it was a kind of a, what do they call it, initiation.
A hazing.
A hazing, correct.
Yeah, but, you know...
Now, she's saying, she said a little bit more. She said... he was nasty, ugly, and she said, I never talked to him again, ever. I didn't want anything to do with
him. Well, I can see that. But that's just his personality. I don't think it had anything to do with...
Yeah, I don't think he's Mr. Personality.
No, I don't see that at all.
Mr. Effervescence.
But, you know, my problem with him is that rigidity. You've got a lot of these people who are ideologically stuck. There will be no compromise with these people. So if they do get into a position of power, there is no room for compromise. And, you know, like the woman in Delaware who doesn't touch herself, at some point, if you get into the Senate, you're going to have to reach across the aisle and reach consensus. And I don't see this group that, this extreme group being able to do that. I just don't.
You know, it would be very interesting. I hope they lose. I don't want to put this country through it. But if they do, and the Tea Party is given a lot of credit, how's the Republican Party going to react?
Oh, there's part of
me. That'll be fascinating from a political side.
There's part of me that thinks that would be great.
Really?
Yeah, I think it would be great.
Okay.
There's part of me that just thinks that would be the greatest thing in the world.
Well, that's good to know.
Because it would be good radio. We would have people to talk about. There'd be things
my
to talk
sentiments
about.
Exactly.
But on the other part of this, you know, the problem would be we would have gridlocked government, which I think we're
yes.
going to have anyway,
yes.
Because we've had it for the last year. We've had Republicans who have stood in the way of any progress, and they've already told you they're going to do that no matter what for the next two.
You know, I think they're going to. I think this movement is going to just chew itself up from within. Why do I say that? You talk to some of the rank and file, and I've seen them interviewed, and they truly believe that both the Republican and the Democratic Party are to blame. Now, when you look at the money, all the money that the Tea Party organizations around the country gave to, every one of them was a Republican. They didn't give them one Democrat.
Yeah, but here's what bothers me.
So at the end, is the loyalty to the party and the ebb and flow of the power structure, is that going to destroy the Tea Party? I think it very well might.
Well, here's what bothers me. The people who would follow this Tea Party thing, they're going to see a victory as, you know, that they did it, and anything that goes wrong will not be the result of what they've done. It will be the result of something else, because what they believe, and these are the people that I've talked to, they believe that their ideology is pure. And it's this blind faith, this religious type, hero worship, if you will.
Well, if you noticed, these teabaggers, there's not a word of who and what, the Bush administration, because they believe those kind of Republicans, and they're correct, I believe, aren't the true conservatives.
Yeah.
They harken back to Double R, Ronald Reagan.
That guy that, I had the discussion with over at the Pennsylvania Chamber, or the Pennsylvania Republican Party, the guy who was really just screaming,
your buddy.
Profanity in the middle of the street with children around. He said George W. Bush was a liberal. And I'm going, really? That's interesting, because I remember him calling himself a compassionate conservative.
No, they call themselves neocons, and he didn't even know that.
Scary, scary stuff. And that's the sad thing, that we are that divided. But hopefully, we can find common ground. Let's take a quick break right here. Right back with Josh Shapiro, state representative from Montgomery County. Stick around.
All this promiscuity that I still can't get in. I'm busy being right, so I won't get left behind. God is a
officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. An attempt to require New York City businesses to provide sick days is likely dead on arrival. City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, often a strong supporter of worker initiatives in the city, expressed her opposition on Thursday to the bill. She made her decision out of concern that it would put undue pressure on small businesses in a down economy. The bill would have required businesses with 20 or more employees to provide 9 sick days per year. Pressure continues to mount on food and janitorial service provider Sodexo. The company has been the target of a nationwide campaign that is seeking better wages, benefits, and job protection for the company's workers. This week saw workers at Denison University, Ohio State University, and Clark University walk off the job to picket the company. The French-based company has been accused of using intimidation tactics against workers who have made it known that they are allied with the Service Employees International Union. Protests have been popping up throughout the United States, and the company has dismissed those strikes and pickets as a smear campaign. In this election cycle, a number of Republicans have gone where few Republicans have gone in previous elections, attacking the minimum wage. The most recent Republican to address issues with the minimum wage is John Racey of West Virginia. Racey recently said if given the opportunity, he would seek to abolish the minimum wage because it restricts how much people could actually get paid if the country adhered to supply and demand. In a debate on Wednesday for Virginia's District 1 House of Representatives seat, incumbent Rob Whitman said publicly for the first time that he opposed the federal minimum wage and believes such wages should be left up to the states. His Democratic opponent, Crystal Ball, told the Virginia Gazette that she supports the federal minimum because even with a minimum wage, people can barely get by. Alaska senatorial candidate Joe Miller went even further, suggesting that the minimum wage is unconstitutional. Miller's position is contrary to the Supreme Court's 1941 ruling in U.S. versus Darby Lumber Company that found that the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established the federal minimum wage, was constitutional. Here's today's economic report. Saturday was National Bosses Day in the United States, but a new survey released by Spherion Staffing suggests few employees used it to celebrate management. The survey discovered that 74% of workers said that during the recession, the relationship they have had with their boss has deteriorated. Workers told the survey they didn't feel like their boss is interested in their career development and will often undermine their progress. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting by Ulico and the OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where common sense, reason, and community come together. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. November 2nd, just around the corner. And what we're doing is we're talking to as many people as we can, getting a feel for, you know, what they're seeing on the campaign trail, what they're seeing in their constituents, what's on their minds, the thought processes going on as we steamroll towards election day or decision day, or as I've heard some say, D-Day. I've got Josh Shapiro on the line. He's a state representative from the 153rd Legislative District out there in Montgomery County. Representative, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rick. It's great to be with you.
You know, I'm looking at this race, and, you know, as I predicted middle of summer, the closer we get to it, the closer the races are going to get because, you know, everybody in the middle is going to start waking up and going, okay, we got to make a decision. The Tea Party had their their big moment, and now I think the rest of the state's waking up, and I'm hoping the adults in the room make the right choice. What are you seeing out on the trail?
Yeah, Rick, I think you're spot on. What I've noticed on the trail over the course of really the last 2 or 3 weeks is a coalescing of Democrats. Dems are coming together, and I think we're a party that traditionally comes together a little late, but we are coming together, and I think that's really largely due to the fact I think the Republicans peaked way too early. If you recall a couple weeks ago when those generic polls came out that showed Republicans with a commanding lead over Democrats, then all of a sudden the focus shifted and the American people started asking the Republicans what they're actually for and what they would do. And then they dusted off that, plan for America or whatever they call it, which was basically, 1994 talking point. got us in this mess in the first place, going back to the George W. Bush policies. And I think the American people are waking up, Pennsylvanians are waking up and saying, wait a sec, we don't want to go backwards. We want to keep going forwards. And I think they realize, as you know, as they've asked themselves that question, do we go forwards or backwards, they're answering they want to go forwards. And so they're taking another look at Joe Sestak and Dan Honorato and our other congressional and state house and state senate candidates, and they're liking what they're seeing. So I think the polls will continue to tighten, and I think Democrats will even start to surprise some people and take a lead in some of these polls. And I think you're already seeing that at the congressional level and even at the statewide level. So I'm very, very optimistic, Rick. We're moving in the right direction.
Yeah, I'm guardedly optimistic. I'm seeing, as you're saying, some of the polls coming together as people are starting to pay attention. I mean, those of us who are junkies in this stuff, who follow the, you know, the horse race day in, day out, we've seen the fringes who are always involved make their choices. It's the people in the middle who are now going to make this choice. You brought up the grand pledge, the big pledge, which was 48 pages long, 27 pages of pictures, and 21 pages of almost words, but no real policy, no real, this is what we're going to do. A lot of flowery language, a lot of rhetoric, but no real plans, nothing that they're willing to cut, no leadership. It's just flowery language, in my opinion.
I think you're right, Rick. It's flowery language that, by the way, Newt Gingrich used in 94, George Bush used in 2000, and now they got three young guns in Washington, these three new Republicans that figure they'll dust it off and try saying the same thing in a different way and try and sell it to the American people. The American people aren't buying it. Pennsylvanians certainly aren't buying it. You know, I think a lot of people were happy for a while hearing the rhetoric of, well, we've got to cut, we've got to live within our means, we're for liberty, we're for freedom. I mean, these are things that Democrats are for also. But what Republicans haven't been able to do is dot the I's and cross the T's and explain to Pennsylvanians how they're actually going to do this stuff. You know, they're against what they deem to be called Obamacare, yet they're for all the good stuff in it. They're just against all the bad stuff, but they're not sort of responsibly speaking about how health care needs to work in Pennsylvania. You know, they're for cutting all kinds of things in the budget until they have to show up at a forum where somebody wants funding for pre-K,
right,
or somebody wants funding for public health. And then they say, no, we're really for that. I mean, the level of hypocrisy is really extraordinary. And I think Pennsylvanians are smarter than that. Pennsylvanians are more centrist than that. I think at the end of the day, Pennsylvanians will wake up and recognize that these guys are selling them the same old stuff they were selling, you know, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. And you look at the guy who's the executive over here for the Harrisburg School District, who came out and said, well, we'll just cut kindergarten, we'll cut pre-K, we'll cut all the sports programs, we'll cut all this stuff out. And what I've seen is I actually saw people get upset about it. There are very few issues that you see people get upset about, but this was one of them.
I think that's right.
As a representative, and you know, I hear this often, we just want to cut, without saying what you'd cut.
Right.
You know, in looking at the budgets that you've fought through, you know, how much fat is there? We keep talking about getting rid of waste, fraud, and abuse, but the reality is I think we're almost to the bone. I don't know that there's much left to cut that isn't things that people depend on.
Yeah, Rick, it's interesting that you use the language about cutting the bone. I've always said we do have to cut the fat out of state government. We've got to eliminate the wasteful spending. We've got to eliminate the duplication. But you can't cut down to the bone, and let me be specific what I mean by that. We can't have programs that people are relying on. You know, an elderly person who relies on their prescription drugs from the state, or a disabled person relying on getting a wheelchair as a result of having a little income and a big disability. We can't turn to those people and say, you're not getting your prescription drugs or you're not getting your wheelchair. What we can do is say, well, the bureaucracy is a little too big and we don't need it to be as big, or we could maybe eliminate some of the wasteful spending associated with that program and things like that. That's going to save you some money, and I've been one of the reformers leading the effort to try and clean up that wasteful spending in Harrisburg. But anybody who thinks that's going to save you $5, $6 billion is, as our attorney general running for governor believes, I think they're sorely mistaken about how government really works in Pennsylvania. Again, there is wasteful spending, and Democrats definitely want to reduce that and eliminate it. But you can't balance your budgets on the backs of people who need help from the government.
Right.
And there are very, very sound investments that we make in our children and our elderly and others who need a helping hand from government that are going to be on the chopping block if people make the wrong decision on November 2nd.
You know, and looking at this, and I was going to bring up the Attorney General. He's taken this no-tax pledge, which to me seems like probably a nice political stunt, but as far as a leader governing a state seems kind of stupid to me. And I'll use that word because I do think it's kind of a dumb thing to do by right from the beginning handcuffing yourself into not raising taxes if you need to.
Right.
But I guess the way he's kind of couched that in a sense is we've just changed the words. We're not going to ask people to be taxed. We're just, I guess, going to ask for more contributions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Look, I've stood for election 3 times, and I'm 3 for 3, and I've never taken any of these pledges. I think anytime you take a pledge as an elected leader, you're limiting yourself, and you're undermining your own authority and independence. And look, I've run in a legislative body. I have even run to be the chief executive, which is what Tom Corbett's running to be. I think as chief executive, you don't want to tie your hands or limit your authority, and I believe that's what he's done by signing this pledge. Now, look, in this economy, with this recession, I've stood tall against raising broad-based taxes. I think that that is not something that Pennsylvanians need right now. But I certainly don't think we should have candidates for the executive here in Pennsylvania taking pledges to dictate what they will do for the next 4 years. I think that that is not responsible public policy making.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. At the end of the day, if you've got two choices, you either have to figure out how you're going to raise some taxes, or you're going to kick granny into the street, or you're going to cut programs for people living in support homes. I think common sense will dictate that you help the people who need the help, and you ask those who have the ability to use a Corbett frame to contribute a little bit more to
right.
help do that.
Right.
That's just and I look at this Marcellus shale tax. To me, it seems like an absolute no-brainer. The majority of people in the state of Pennsylvania want it. There was a deadline October 1st. Here we are weeks later, no extraction tax.
No, and Rick, remember, the Democratic-controlled state house, we passed the severance tax. And it's important for your listeners to understand this is a tax paid by gas drillers, not by Pennsylvanians. Right now, Pennsylvanians are paying to clean up the mess of these big gas drillers here in our Commonwealth. They're cleaning up the environmental damage that they create. They're having to fix the roads and bridges that these, the big trucks that travel through with the drilling equipment are crumbling. I don't think that my constituents and other Pennsylvanians should be forced to pay for the mess of these gas drillers. I think the gas drillers should pay for it. We passed a responsible severance tax in the state house. We sent it over to the Senate. The Senate never even called it up for a vote. And Rick, I got to tell you, it's a clear example of why we need campaign finance reform. Take a look at the Senate Republican leaders, how much money they've taken from these gas drillers, and it'll be no wonder why they never even brought this bill up for a vote. The gas drillers didn't want it, and so the Senate Republicans did exactly what the gas drillers said and didn't bring it up. And I think it's a reason why we need campaign finance reform, why people are frustrated with Harrisburg because they see big special interest money dominating the discussion there. I'm proud of what my Democratic and some Republican colleagues did in the state house in passing this, and I think it's shameful that the Senate didn't follow suit.
I'm right there with you, but here's the thing. If we don't get it done by January, and let's say Tom Corbett wins, he has taken a no-tax pledge, do we never get the extraction tax, and do we lose that revenue, which I've seen in the last year to be $60, $70 million?
Oh, it's hundreds of millions of dollars. And, I mean, look, Corbett has made it clear he's not going to he's not in favor of the severance tax. I think he's been very clear and very consistent. I actually admire him for his consistency on this issue. I happen to fundamentally disagree with his position. Dan Honorato has made it clear that he supports a responsible and reasonable severance tax. I think Pennsylvanians do, too. When they hear that they're on the hook for cleaning up the mess of these gas drillers, they're outraged. My constituents are outraged by it. They're upset about the negative environmental impact, and they're outraged by the fact that their tax dollars are going to clean up the mess that these drillers have. And when you think about it this way, Rick, in Sarah Palin's Alaska, in George W. Bush's Texas, they passed a severance tax. And the fact is we should be doing the same thing here in Pennsylvania.
Absolutely agree. And, you know, the thing that bothers me is, you know, you look at the money that's gone I've seen somewhere between $350,000 and $900,000 going to the Corbett campaign from the natural gas industry. To me, that's just plain wrong.
Right. Well, look, I mean, I think in Pennsylvania, we have no limits on how much people can contribute. I think we need to change that. It's why I've sponsored comprehensive campaign finance reform legislation. The fact is that we've got transparency here. People know that Tom Corbett's taken hundreds of thousands of dollars from the gas drillers, and they'll be able to make a judgment come election day as to whether or not that's the type of leadership they want sitting in the governor's chair here in Pennsylvania.
I sure hope that gets through. Last question I have for you, in looking at the senatorial race down in your area really, most importantly, I think, for Joe Sestak, is that people get out to vote and come out in big numbers, because I think he needs it. Are you surprised that someone who is so extreme that even Rick Santorum called him extreme has been able to pull himself to the middle with these campaign ads that he's run?
I think Pat Toomey has done a pretty good job of faking out the people of Pennsylvania and trying to come across as a moderate, from the way his commercials are cut to how he dresses and, you know, the tone he takes. It's completely different from who the real Pat Toomey is. I mean, the real Pat Toomey, if you examine his record, is to the right of Rick Santorum. Pennsylvania already threw out Rick Santorum because he was too extreme.
Yeah.
So I don't think at the end of the day Pennsylvanians will be fooled by Pat Toomey's attempts tend to be moderate. And folks, one of the reasons why Sestak, the polls is either tied or with against Pat Toomey, Stan Honorato tied or within the margin of error. And remember, these guys were down double digits for a big part of this campaign. Democrats are coming home. I think Democrats and independents and even many moderate Republicans down here in eastern Pennsylvania are looking at the Republican ticket and saying, you know what, these guys are a little too extreme for us. Signing on to lawsuits to do away with a health care law that's going to help women with breast cancer who today can't get health insurance. We're siding, as Tom Corbett has, we're siding with Wall Street time and time again and saying they should be unregulated, as Pat Toomey has. You know, this is not mainstream values, Pennsylvania, and I think particularly in the Southeast, where the key of winning this region is getting moderates, is having a real hard time closing that deal. And I think the more people are hearing about some of the extreme positions that that General Corbett has taken, they're having some concerns with him as well.
And let's hope more people wake up between now and Election Day on November 2nd. State Representative Josh Shapiro, I appreciate you taking
time. Thanks. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
All righty. Thanks. Take a quick break right here. Right back after.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
On June 25th, 1938, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act into law. Viewed as one of the final pieces of legislation of FDR's New Deal and the single most worker-friendly piece of legislation ever written, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 was a victory not only for labor unions, but for workers, families, and children across the country. FDR called the new law the most far-reaching, far-sighted program for the benefit of workers ever adopted in this country. This visionary piece of legislation put a ceiling hours and a floor under wages, mandating a 44, 25-cent minimum wage and time and a half for overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act was later amended to 40 hours per week and 40 cents per hour. The law also excluded from working dangerous jobs and set standard conditions for the employment of child workers to avoid continued exploitation of children. The Fair Labor Standards Act has been released three different times. These alterations have been used both to expand worker protections, such as raising the minimum wage, prohibiting age discrimination, and requiring equal pay, and to restrict and take away, such as the Taft Hartley Act and the 2004 Fair Pay Amendment. Today, we take the 40 work week, minimum wage, overtime, and child protections for granted. But up until the passage of the Fair Labor Standards, workers were at the mercy of their employers. Children were dying in industrial accidents. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Radio of, for, and by three people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell are we fighting for? Just surrender it all. Just got time to say your prayer.
well, what we're fighting for, quite simply, is a better life for ourselves, our children, our grandchildren. We're fighting for health care, decent jobs. We're fighting for a prosperous America, an America with where the dream is still possible, where we're fighting for crumbs, one where workers end up having to take a dollar an hour as some. You listen to this guy from West Virginia saying, well, minimum wage, we should do away with that. Workers should be able to get paid whatever they want. Kind of a really silly thing. But if you see tonight's debate, which was kind of an interesting moment, Tom Corbett said he is never ever going to raise taxes or fees. Never ever. I'm sure it was one of those reacts, but it was still a never ever moment, which I thought was funny. But again, interesting debate. Sadly, I don't know that it was televised around here, or at least we couldn't find it. We had to watch it online. Anyway, let's go to the phone lines. We got Helen on line one. How are we doing tonight, Helen?
Hi. Yeah, I watched it, tuned in late to you guys, and thought it was pretty good, except Mr. Honorato doesn't bring up some of the things that you brought up here that he could have used. And the one thing that he did that I think was really wrong was he touched that third rail of politics in Pennsylvania. The gun thing. Yeah. Oh, my God. It was like, oh, dude, you can fit this, but in Pennsylvania you don't.
Well, he was in Philadelphia. You've got to understand that that's what Philadelphia voters want to hear.
Well, I lived in Philadelphia. There are people in Philadelphia who are both Republican and Democrat who are very gun-minded. And he just, Corbett said was exactly what the Supreme Court has ruled. And the best thing Honorato could have done was say, yes, the Supreme Court ruled, and we have to go by that law, just like he did with the abortion issue. You know, he could have done the thing. Instead, he had to step in the mud pie that did, you know.
Yeah, we know what the morning paper is going to say.
We know what especially in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. And in Pittsburgh, you know, the paper here did come out Corbett. I'm glad I don't subscribe to it anymore.
Really. But here's the thing. I still think Honorato did a very good job. I think he did a very good job of putting his message out that, look, he didn't raise property taxes. He did things that the next governor is going to need to do, whether I like it or not.
Right.
To me, again, I think he is the right person for this,
looking at the opposition, but there's a lot of people that are not going to be bothered to think about that because they're going to think about that one issue. I loved it the other night. They had some young people calling in. Finally, after all the shills got finished, there were some young people able to get in and say, you know, we don't care about some of these wedges. We want jobs.
Yep.
But there's a lot, unless they come out and vote, we're going to be in a mess.
And we don't know if they will or not because they're not being polled. None of this polling data includes 25 and under. None of it. Because most of the people I know who are 25 and under, they don't have landlines.
My kid is 37, and she and her husband don't have landlines.
But I'm getting to that point. I mean, almost I don't need it anymore. We have, we've got cell phones now.
Yeah, and they don't have anything like that. So there's a lot of old, not just the 20-something, 30-somethings, and there's other, a lot of the older people I know don't have landlines because they found that, it's less expensive.
Yep. And, when you go back and you start talking about polling, I've been telling people that, we're kind of reading the same thing that, if you remember the election between Roosevelt and the polling had Hoover winning by a landslide.
Yeah.
Because the only people who had phones back then were the wealthy people who were okay. and you missed a whole segment of the population. And as we know, it went the other way. And I think this election is going to have of that as well, because they're really not sure if the younger vote's going to come out. And I'm hoping they do.
Well, there's another thing you're talking about, the landline. I can calling me on my, if I have my television on. And there's a lot of times I don't bother to answer if it's an 800 number or some goofy thing that I don't know. and they may well be bolstered, and I'm not responding.
See, I'm one of those people who give every answer that you can think of, I give the outrageous answer. If you're going to bother calling me at home, you're getting the most obnoxious answer I can come up with.
So we're two people that, well, I probably am not getting polled either because I'm not answering it, and you're giving goofy answers.
Yeah, my goal is to throw the polls off because at the end of the day, it's going to come down to what happens, who gets the vote out, who has the most people show up. And I think the more we learn about Tom Corbett, the more we learn about Pat Toomey, I think the more energized people are going to be to repel him office.
I certainly hope so. I when I heard that, I was just, oh, my God, you may think that. Because I was working politics when Mr. Stengel was running. And we office and we asked them questions, bring to help. And I just say, by the way, I'm a gun owner. Where does he stand on this? And the young woman in the office here in Harrisburg, some little twit from Villanova, volunteer.
No, be nice.
We don't want any gun people in our group. Well, unfortunately, already volunteering were some people from, as I said, oh, I guess you don't want me, and started to leave, got up and walked out.
Yeah, that's tolerance. I don't know that I would want her working for me.
Yeah, that was, and I'm hoping that, you know, the same thing doesn't happen with him because look what we got.
I don't think the gun issue is going to come up. I think right now the economy is the issue.
I hope that's, you know, what those kids were saying.
And I honestly don't think Honorado is going to get out there and try and work again.
I don't think he's going to do it unless they put a bill in front of them.
And that's not going to happen in this state. So it's one of those that, you know, it's one of those potholes that Corbett threw in. At the end of the day, it's going to come down to, for me.
You're going to have to find somehow or other to backtrack and say, well, I'm not going to do this unless, you know, it's in front of me.
Right. But at the end of it, for me, it comes to the Marcellus Shale. It comes down to the fact that Corbett is adamantly opposed to sharing in that resource. That should be the red flag for every citizen in this state. He's going to allow these corporations profit from it, take the profits out of the state, and leave us high and dry down the road. That's the reality of it.
The Bet, what's her name? The Bet from down in Philadelphia.
Joseph.
She was on one of the cable stations being interviewed, and she was quite good about it. You know, even though that is exactly her issue, so what to say, she kept pushing the environmental issues, the poisoning of the water and things like that.
Yep.
Not just the money, the emotional issues.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is you're going to just have to look at the coal mining industry in this country or in this state and see what we're left with. You can go back and you can look at the boom bust cycle that happened around all the coal towns. That's where we're headed with the shale. Now, how do
we
mitigate
that? Oh, and that town is Centralia.
That's right.
Yes, I always forget the name, and when you said it the other night, I thought, what is it? What is it? And I finally remembered.
It's still on fire to this day. We got to be careful here, Alan. I appreciate the call.
Sure, bye-bye.
Thanks so much. To me, that's the issue. At the end of it, it's the issue that this guy, Corbett, is adamantly opposed to a sane, rational, reasonable tax they're taking out of the ground.
Well, the other part of that... natural gas issue is the fact that he hasn't even brought it up one time about pressing these Pennsylvanians. Absolutely. I promise you, if I'm governor, when they go to get a permit from the state, there will be language in there mandating that you hire Pennsylvanians. And at the end of the day, you know, we are crazy if we don't maximize the opportunity for economic growth and an opportunity for a good job for as many Pennsylvanians as possible.
Now you're looking at a possibility of hundreds of millions of dollars that could go into the state's coffers that he's just willing to let go. Let's take a quick break right here. We'll be right back with your calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-74. Back after this.
My moan go. I wear a cowboy hat, business AM. I must tell you, I'm a man with a mission.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the mayor.
Old Congress creditors never die, they just wait. Into lobbying, that is.
Take former House Speaker Haskard, former House Majority Leader Armey and Dick Gephardt, and former Senate leaders Bob Dole and Trent Lott. The names of these one-time legislative powerhouses aren't mentioned in the news anymore, so perhaps you would assume that they've retired back to the old home place or even passed away. But no, they're very much alive and still plying the legislative arts. Only they now do it for million-dollar paychecks as lobbyists for Wall Street financial giants and other corporate interests. Haskard, Armey, Gephardt, Dole, and Lott are among a cadre of 73 former members of Congress who've been working in recent or kill new regulations to rein in the gouging and reckless gang of the big financial firms. They're not the only former public insider knowledge and personal connections in Washington to serve the bankers. For example, at least 66 staffers for the House or Senate banking committees have moved from Capitol Hill to the K Street lobbying corridor. And another 82 staffers for members of those committees also are now lobbyists for the finance industry. Adding even more firepower to this special interest army of influence peddlers are 42 former officials from the Treasury Department. This is Jim Hightower saying, in an effort to slow down the shameless service, the watchdog group Public Citizen contacted 47 current lawmakers who are retiring this year. The group asked them to pledge not to take a lobbying job for 2 years with any corporation that had lobbied them. Not a single one took the pledge. To see who the 47 are and to get behind stricter lobbying rules, contact Public Citizen at www.citizen.org/revolvingdoor.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fellow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Absolutely agree, it is a time for a change. You know, with this debate this evening, and I love these debates, and this time of year for me is, this time in the election cycle is just pure political joy. Because you get to see people unvarnished. And that's what you get with these commercials, behind the commercials, when they're standing each other, facing each other eye to eye, you find out a lot about them. And you find out, in my opinion, what their positions are, because they're not going to stand there and lie right to somebody's face. The whole thing, I got to give the guy in Kentucky, he came out and said, look, you know, you got to explain this Iowa Buddha thing, not getting it. And Rand Paul got all offended and he marched off like a petulant child. I think that's a fantastic, it's a scenario that I love to see played out again and again, standing next to each other and duking it out, and not with all of these, because if you remember during the, they had all these rules and, we won't do this, and we won't talk about this. And 32 pages of rules for the one debate that Kerry had. I'm going, 32 pages of rules for a debate?
And to a large degree, both sides, for each subject that they knew was going to come up, they all had, a canned answer.
And of course, you know, he had the little thing in his back with the... Remember that whole controversy where they thought it was a transmitter in the back of his coat where somebody was feeding him the answers? You don't remember that?
Yeah, I do. And you know what? If it happened in Florida, anything's possible.
Yeah, well. But anyway, going back to our good governor, you know, I went on our Facebook page, and again, you can sign up for our Facebook page at either Rick Smith or The Rick Smith Show. I put up, you know, the fact that Tom Corbett said...
Let's make it, again, very, very clear. I'm the only person here that has signed a pledge not to increase taxes. I'm also made a promise. We will not increase any fees. Not now, not ever.
Not now, not ever. So the pledge has gone on, we're not going to raise taxes, too. We're not going to raise taxes or fees. Never, ever. Ever. I mean, stop and think about that for a second. Ever. I mean, if that's not say anything politic, I don't know what is. And just a couple minutes later, he says
that's right now, I believe, is appropriate.
So right now it's not appropriate to raise taxes, but just 2 minutes earlier you said never, ever, ever, never, ever. No, no, never, ever. Not going to happen. And he goes on talking about cuts and cuts. And look, I talked with Josh. He wants to cut, folks. until you get down to the bone and people start suffering.
We will start cutting the spending as soon as we get into office. We'll work with the legislature to go in and cut the size of state government, to cut the costs of state government, to cut the spending of state government, is start lowering those taxes. And there's a whole list of taxes, and you can look at them on our website at tomcorbettforgovernor.com. The corporate net income tax, the capital stock and franchise tax, the inheritance tax.
So let me ask, because, you know, if we're cutting taxes on corporations, how much cut in social programs? And, you know, I look at the folks we had here for the first hour of the program, talking about helping people in their homes, getting home health aides to come to people's homes and care for them in their homes so that they don't have to be in nursing homes. They don't have to be institutionalized. They can have some respect. They can have some dignity. And you know what? We, the taxpayers, can save some money in the process. Where are we going to do this if we're cutting everything? Look, the answer to me is not continuing to cut taxes. The answer to me is have smart government, not necessarily to the government, but smart government that's effective to people where they see a value in their dollar and they see that what they're, like this home health care thing. I think this is a fabulous value. There's not a lot of profit in it, though. Which is why seeing people out there doing an awful lot of it. And I hope that they're able to organize these people and get them a decent standard of living. I think it would be a great thing. Because I don't know what we're going to do when you get to be.
No, you're right. You're old. Is that older? Are you verifying that? older? Well, I mean, I'm part of the baby boomers.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot of us suckers out there. And I know this is a shock, but every day we get older, Rick. So.
I'm getting older with you, too.
No, you are correct about that. As we get older, there's more and more and more in our healthcare system. And this is a good way to take care of that added stress on the system.
But here's a good thing, a real good thing. A new study was conducted by Columbia University. Health policy professors by the name of Peter Muening and Sherry Gilded. It's going to appear in the November edition of Health Affairs. We have now fallen from 24th in the world for life expectancy down to 49th. So the good thing is we're not living as long. So we probably won't have to pick up those costs long term. Life expectancy for both male and female has declined. So the good thing, I guess, you know, people aren't living as long. We won't have to live so long.
There you go. If that's a plug.
Well, that seems to be that we want to do things. It seems the right-wingers want it.
I thought the ultimate aim of health care is to keep you healthy, but also to extend life where possible.
No. Profit. We need profit in health care. And, I love to hear the Republicans go, we're number one, we're number one.
Let me ask you.
Number 49.
You should cheer when they hear that because that means they can raise Social Security costs.
There you go. See? It's a lot of good, things come apart when you die.
You know, and all those old... Worthless curmudgeons in their eyes aren't going to be sucking off the Social Security system.
That's right.
So we don't have to support them, even though they're not really supporting them because they worked all their life and had their tax collar and the tax dollars of their employers come off their check, every paycheck many years as they worked.
But didn't you know? All that money's gone. It's spent. It built roads. Like Alan Simpson said, it's gone. But built roads and stuff. Get over it.
You talk about an old curmudgeon. Now, there's an old curmudgeon that ought to retire. You know what I mean?
From your lips.
Wow.
A new study set to appear in the Archives of Surgery. A whole new study. In the Archives of Surgery claims over a period of 6.5 years, doctors in Colorado alone operated on the wrong patient at least 25 times and on the wrong body 107 times. They're saying wrong patient, wrong state procedure count for about 0.5% of all medical mistakes. Claim the numbers are higher than previously thought. And, you know, they're blaming the mix-up on human error because, of course, you got nurses that are working double shifts. You got doctors who are working long hours. Of course, you're going to have some problems. And what I love to hear the right's, you know, answer to health care. The right's answer is always, and I heard a bunch of people running for Senate saying this, that blunt guy from Missouri. we need tort reform. We need to stop this medical practice so people don't practice defensive medicine. Okay. How about some, you know, making sure other people have health care? We don't want to talk about that. Dr. Martin Marquet, he is a professor of surgery and public health at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, said catastrophic surgery errors are a lot more common than the public thinks. Each hospital, he says, whether they publicly admit or whether or not they discover it's discoverable in a lawsuit, has had an episode of wrong site, wrong patient surgery every year, or at least once every few years. A surgeon at Denver Health Medical Center said one of the worst cases, now think of it for a second, he said one of the worst cases that he ever saw was two patients who had prostate biopsies. One had cancer, one did not. The who did the tests mixed up the samples. So the patient without cancer had a radical prostatectomy, which is it's basically slitting you from the back right up the middle and going in and ripping out your prostate. And then there's a whole bunch of radiation and chemotherapy that go along with that, which is just horribly invasive. And the person who actually had cancer was out there just, you know, walking around like nothing's wrong because he didn't know anything was wrong. That, to me, is scary. When I went and I had my knee operated on, I had my left knee operated on, and my right knee I wrote in magic marker, not this one.
Not taking any chances.
Because, you know, you hear these stories to have appendix taken out, and they end up missing a foot when they come out. I mean, things happen. You know, as the guy points out, they rely on nurses to tell them where things are at. And sometimes nurses can make mistakes. Surgeons make mistakes because, you know, they deal with it. And, you know, I got to be honest with you. You know, stop and think about this. How do you go and compensate someone for going through the pain and misery that is a prostate surgery? Because they do. They slit you from right up there, right? Whole, you know, bottom, up your right in half.
I get the picture, Rick.
And they rip it right out. And then there's the recovery that comes along with them, the chemotherapy, and the fact that, hey, you don't have a prostate anymore. And in most cases, no prostate means no, fun. No fun for the one, if you
Why
will.
Why don't you just...
Can't say it. I'm a terrestrial radio.
No sex?
None of that.
You can't say sex?
Well, I don't know. No, Mr.
I think you can.
No Mr. Happy.
Well, okay. Two comments.
Mr. Happy's a shrunken head.
How many times have you heard the Republicans in Pennsylvania talk about containing health care costs? They talk about tort reform. And what's the first thing on?
Well, because of all these defensive medicine lawsuits, with too many doctors leaving the state. Well, actually, you don't. We have an increase in the last couple of years.
I believe that revolves around the care fund, I remember, which was an effort to compensate doctors. But they failed to mention that. The other thing, and this goes way back. I remember reading articles 15, 20 years ago about how I think Pennsylvania was one of the worst. You know, the doctors don't enforce among their own, the ones that are incompetent. And it's just like any place. A lot of times you have people that are constantly in trouble, a small percentage.
Yep.
And so it is with doctors.
They close.
Have a small percentage of doctors that commit a lot of these malpractice suits, and they don't, they don't enforce their own ranks. They don't police their own ranks. So before you come to the consumer, before you come to me and ask me to give up my rights, and that's what people, a lot of Republicans don't understand, they got money. Watch what you give up, because it might be your right you give up.
Well, it is your right. It's your what? I go back to this guy. No prostate, none of that. And the time, the productive time, the anguish of going, holy, I may die. I've got cancer. I mean,
but what about the
all guy, because of just a little?
What happened to the cancer patient that didn't know?
The study didn't go into that. They don't.
That can't be healthy. I'd like to know when they found out.
It could probably be part of an ongoing suit. which you really can't. You know, nobody's going to talk to you about while it's still going
on. I mean,
on.
Why shouldn't the individual, just like you saw some, compensate it? Well, you know what? Here's one thing, and the AMA, I think, failed to realize, or maybe don't care. Look, if you prevent, by nailing them for $1 million or more, I don't know, depending on Revis, the omission was, the mistake was, I don't know that they'll compensate you, but it might prevent that in the future where doctors say, whoa.
So I say they cut off
the money. Whoa, I better make sure that, you know, I do this right.
Yep. What if they cut off the wrong leg? What's that worth to you? That's an entire lifestyle change. Mm. You are never going to be the same again. Let's take a quick break. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Changing America for the better.
Washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old microwave?
And just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repairs, 243-3211.
Here at The Radiation, we call mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Some politicians say the unemployed won't look for work until their benefits run out.
Ed has been laid off from his pipe fitting job for over 18 months.
I'm here to tell you, being out of work is no fun. It sets you back in life. Benefits provide for less than half your wages. There's no health care. Your family suffers. To those politicians who think anybody would rather collecting unemployment than working, I say come join us. We won't forget on Election Day.
This Labor Day message brought to you by the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO, Richard Bloomingdale President, Frank Snyder, Secretary Treasurer.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know?
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show. Progressive talk with a conscience.
While they're stabbing in welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of the arms of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines.
You know where the revolution's going to be? The revolution is going to be with my daughter and her generation. That's where the revolution is going to be. They're the generation I think is going to be the next greatest generation. Because they're going to be the ones to mop up now. They're the ones who are going to have to clean up the aftermath Tea Party. They're the ones who have to do this stuff. And I give President Obama a lot of credit for some of what he's done. In fact, he's making a cameo appearance on Discovery Channel's Mythbusters. And the idea behind it is to kind of create an increased interest in math and science education. The episode that he is supposed to air in December and will test the myth that Greek scientists really set fire to an invading Roman fleet using only mirrors and reflecting rays of the sun. Through, though it's unclear how the president will be involved, he will be there, and I think it's interesting. And I think it does. It encourages children. And the fact that he's taken an interest to have each year of his presidency a welcome back to school moment. Because I think he understands that's going to be the generation that returns this country to its greatness. They will be the greatest generation because a lot's going to be expected of them. An awful lot. And speaking of my daughter, tomorrow I'll be attending her school. There's a dedication ceremony tomorrow where Governor Rendell is going to come out and dedicate the solar panels that they've built on her school. That, to me, should have been something we were doing all along. Should have been doing it across this state, across the country. You know, look, this this solar thing that they've built, and it's a magnificent site.
It's huge.
It's a magnificent site. It's going to power the school, and they're going to be able to sell excess energy back to the grid and actually be able to make some profit off of it.
And nobody charges them for the sun. Isn't that amazing?
And it's amazing. They've got a couple of them that are on pivots like flowers that follow the sun. It's amazing what they have done. The technology is fantastic. And, again, this is smart investment.
What have they projected that it will take to pay itself off? Right?
I think it was 6 years.
Oh, is that all?
It's going to pay itself back.
That's short term.
I mean, I was shocked that it was only 6 years, and I think somebody told me it was 6 years, because just think about how much electricity it takes to run a school.
Well, the question then comes up, why don't other school districts do it?
What's the upfront money? You know, you got these people who are afraid to invest. They're afraid we might have to raise a short-term tax.
And we won't be reelected.
Again, but you know, listen, who's on all the school boards?
Business people.
All business people, all Republicans, all I care is about the bottom line type folks. And you know, folks, I'm telling you, this is why we've been starving schools. From the top down, we've had politicians who've made their hay off of cutting taxes, and what happens? We cut education. Because it's one of the big things. Oh, we can cut a little here, a little there, cut a little there. And now we're talking about doing away with kindergarten, doing away with pre-K, doing away with sports programs. And I'll be the one to tell you right here and now. I don't know it for sure, but I got to tell you, I don't think I would have finished high school had it not been for playing football. Because I just was not interested in it. I was just not there. I was going through major turmoil in my life, and I just didn't want to be there. I had no will to be in school, and I had no push from.
Well, you probably would have acted out your aggression at the wrong place at the wrong time.
And I was doing that anyway. That was going on anyway. I was beating people up left and right because it felt good to be.
Isn't it wonderful now you can take that anger and beat people up and be considered a sports hero, very popular in your school.
Yes, yeah.
And you're doing the same thing. You just have a football uniform on.
Well, there was that, but you know, the reality is I moved to a white neighborhood where, you know, all the fighting I had lost in the poverty neighborhood, I was now beating up on upper middle class white kids who, you know, they couldn't defend
themselves. They didn't have to fight every day.
They didn't. But no, I mean, the reality is, and this is, it's difficult to think about, but there could have been a possibility where I wouldn't have finished school had it not been for playing sports.
I mean, you told me stories of guys you grew up with that never made it out of the hood.
Never made it out of a box. I knew a bunch of people who didn't live very long, but that's a whole other story. But when I hear people talking about cutting sport programs, that scares me, because you need these things, sports especially, because it builds teamwork, it builds cooperation, understanding of how to relate to people, to make crucial, quick decisions that have consequences. All of those life lessons, and I know you're a big advocate of sport and the life lessons that they teach. But to me, to be talking about cutting this stuff or charging families $200-$300 a sport, I've seen some outrageous numbers. Well, and just to me seems
silly. It's not just the sports. I mean, right here in the Capitol, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Harrisburg High probably in the last 30 years has had as many very good quality athletes that went on to major college in especially football and basketball. And what does that do? Many of them are from low income. And the truth is, if they wouldn't have gotten a scholarship, they probably wouldn't have gone to college. Or at the very least, that chance would have been diminished.
I mean, it's not even just for them. I mean, every person that participates in a sport learns teamwork, learns sportsmanship, learns so much from it. And to say, well, you know, we need to cut taxes, so we're going to lose that leadership ability. To me, that's very short-sighted, and it's not good policy. Look, these are going to be, as I'm saying, my kids' generation, they're going to be, in my opinion, that greatest generation, or I'm praying they will be, or there's not much hope left for this country. Because after these next 2 years, if the O'Donnells and the Angles and the Rand Pauls, you know, the meatball woman over there in Delaware, if they get there, their way, we are in deep, deep trouble.
Well, if you remember, a couple times the president tried to make beach, and these school districts had the option. I think a lot of the opposition was that they don't want these kids getting the idea that one of their life goals should. Oh, I don't know. Maybe making the world a better place. Gee, I mean, you talk about undermining the country. How dare they try to make the world a better place? Yeah.
So tomorrow the governor's going to be out at our school district. We'll say hello to him and thank him for his vision, his foresight. Tomorrow we are not going to be here. Bob Kincaid is going to sit in during our time slot from 9 to midnight right here. I want to thank Bob. Treat him well. Make sure you get to him early and often and keep him entertained. Great being here tonight. I want to thank all of our guests. That home health care aid thing, that still got me thinking about smart policy. Seems like the right thing to do at the right time when we need it the most, especially as your generation grows older and needs that kind of assistance. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you want to email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Have a great night. See you back here on Wednesday.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.